Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
How are you?
Should have both swims yesterday.
Why? What's happened?
Toftoids, cold wind.
Ah, right. I thought you meant somebody had just had 440s out of the swim you were going to move to.
No, someone is setting up in there. Like, there's about four people arrived this morning.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, we are live. We are recording.
What, you're recording now?
It's recording, yes. So don't slag them all off.
No, I'm not slagging anyone off.
No.
I don't slag people off, you know me.
No, of course not. Nobody does. We are perfect human beings.
Yeah, this is a nice, happy little bubble we all live in. Just going to plug my headphones in. Talk for 10 seconds.
Okay, so just to set the scene, I caught Mark off guard there. Mark is fishing his second session on his new syndicate. I don't know if we can probably say where it is, I think.
Yeah, it's Monk's Bay. It's no big secret. There's no publicity bans. There's videos all over YouTube of it. If you want to watch Dave Lane's action down there, that's some good videos.
Yes, and I'd say somebody else who you might bump into in the very near future, or maybe one of the four people that have just turned on this morning, who at 7:30 p.m. this evening, every Tuesday and Wednesday in fact, gets it on in some quite dramatic fashion on the lake. Have you seen Mr. Don this morning?
Oh, serious. I've not, no. To be honest, I was up early on and I went back to bed. I've just literally woken up, made a brew, and you phoned me.
Ah. Well, yeah, I spoke to the Don yesterday, actually, and I told him you were on there, and he went, "Oh, Mark, I might see him in the morning." yeah, he's on, and we'll be tuning in about half. So he had 29,000 views of the video he made last Tuesday night, which I think is pretty incredible.
I watched a bit of it, and he's like, and he's busy giving shout-outs to people with his lights going. Is that all it was, or was he just
no, that's it,
doing other stuff? That's it.
That's it. He told me yesterday he bought two new strobes for tonight. He's trying to get a smoke machine in the bivvy. You can get some battery powered smoke machines, which he's also trying to do. I said he should just take up vaping, because some of those vapings will fill his bivvy pretty quickly.
Yeah, do you think I should do something similar on the lines of a Rammstein gig?
Heavy metal heaven.
Yeah, that ain't going to get many views. Just like, there's not enough room to headbang or get a good pit going in here anyway.
I've just been speaking to Clive Gibbons about the gig we're doing at the angling show in a couple of weeks. Yeah, and I made the point that the last time I was playing in a rock band many, many years ago, I had hair. So I'm looking at wigs. I'm going out wig shopping this week. I'm going to have to be able to headbang at some point. We'll play out the Clive interview a little bit later on. So generally, let's go back to the start. This is episode number 70. It'll be a while before one of us catches a 70-pounder, I think, Mark. Don't you?
Yeah, definitely. I might never catch one. I'm never actually... probably never even going to fish for one. You know, I'm not really into the foreign fishing, never done it. Not saying I never will, but I'm just happy doing my thing up here. But you're into your foreign climbs. Do you think you'll ever get onto a water, a rainbow or somewhere that's got these donkeys in?
Yeah, I'm not sure about Rainbow. I'd like to go to Rainbow, but certainly there are plenty of foreign waters that have 70s in. I'm sure Lake Bled's got a 70. I'm probably going back there this summer for a few days. Croatia's got plenty bigger than that, and I'm definitely doing a week's fishing in Croatia this summer. Don't know where. I'll be looking for info. Probably Mr. Rob Hughes seems to be the man in the know for those sort of countries.
I think Frank Warrington might have information on the continent as well.
Frank's been fishing that place in Italy, hasn't he? It's got many, many large fish in. I'm looking forward to a bit of that. I mean, I'm surprised it's not on your tick list at the minute, because at my age, I don't want to get in the rat race of competing with the young'uns now on the circuit waters, and I'm very competitive, and I'm obsessive as well. So once I start fishing somewhere, you kind of have to see it through, don't you? So if I joined a syndicate, where you're fishing for, like we fished in the past, where you're fishing low stock for, a handful of fish, it feels like you can't miss a week, can you? Because, if the fish is out that week, you might have missed the only chance of the year. Or you start learning stuff and you have to kind of come back the week after to capitalize on that, or you start working out patterns where the fish are moving or patrol routes. And I want to get out of that sort of fishing. And I know once I started doing it, if I joined a lake that and started noticing the stuff, I'd want to be there every week. And I'm trying to avoid that sort of fishing because I know I'll just slip back into it. So I'd rather fish for, right, this is my session, I've got 4 days in front of me, or a week's holiday, or whatever. Let's fish for, fish for the moment type thing, and then not get suckered into bugger, I've got to go back next week now because whatever, I've sussed something out. Or
I think being an air amongst, it's kind of the middle of the two. And I've got my brain, the cogs are ticking now. I'm getting to know this. You mentioned second session. It's really my first, even though I was down here last week. It was more of the rods were out, but it was, like a filming, working thing. So it wasn't serious fishing.
Tell us about the stock in there. That'll give people a better idea.
It's full of chunks. I don't know the exact numbers, but a good, several hundred. I'm sure I'll find out more the more I fish. But there is, well, I'll go from the top. There's the big one, which is, I think it's been up to about 52 at the tops. There's another 3 45 pluses, 15 or more over 40.
Wow.
And then how many 30s is anyone's guess? Over 100, maybe over 150.
Wow.
Maybe 300, 400, 500 total stock.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty impressive. It's a bit like sort of pit one stock when we first died on there.
Yeah, I'd say it's the stock's probably better than pit one, but no, I'll say it. The main difference between here and pit one I'm noticing at the minute is I've not met a wanker yet. there doesn't seem to be the cliquey. You're not walking past swims and people are just turning the back and just totally ignoring you like you don't exist. Everyone I've met down here so far, and including the bailiff, is seems to be spot on. That's the atmosphere I'm getting.
Let me just put a little disclaimer in here. Is the pit one of 15 years ago may very well not be the pit one of today. And there were also some nice people that we met on pit one. So we're not tarring everybody with the brush. But I know what you mean. I mean, not just pit one, but there is a number of old school carp lakes that were kind of kept secret back in the day, or that they had bigger than average fish for the time, and they didn't welcome newcomers, especially traveling anglers like yourself and me and whoever. And I've seen all those things happen that you've just described. People were wet nets hanging up in the wet nets and wet slings hanging up at the back of the swim, and it's like, all right, mate, any good? He went, no, nothing. And that's if they don't turn the back on you when you walk past. And sadly, there used to be a bit of that in carp fishing, so maybe it's improved. But you're saying there's absolutely none of that on Monks?
I've not encountered any so far. It seems to be a nice place to fish, with people like, Ed Betteridge, who you recorded with down here last week. Enjoyed it. Indeed, I got down from his session on Sunday evening, chatting to a fellow. I think I briefly met him last week, but first time I've had a proper chat. And it just had a 39 and told me exactly where he'd got it from.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean,
so
I suppose in a lake like that, there's enough fish to go around, isn't there? There's enough fish for everybody. Bloody 130s and, like, what, 15 plus 40s. It's yeah, great, you all want to catch the 50, but it's not like there's 10 carp in the lake and 150 that everybody's after. Like, there's a shed load of fish you want to catch, isn't there? So,
I guess. Yeah, it's a numbers game. As much as I like, you know, the big ones, I'm not going to target any individual fish apart from a fully scaled in here that's. Well, I've got pictures of my phone of it at 38. But again, you play the numbers game. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm just watching the tufties diving on my spot now, so if you hear a buzzer scream, it may not be the climax you're after. Although, 5 minutes into my recording with Ed, his sounder box went on top of the bivvy, but you'll have to wait to see what happened there.
Yeah, well, you'll have to wait another week, because this week we have Gary Bays as the guest. I recorded him a few weeks ago, and it was a good Gary ramble, which you'll be hearing shortly. Roger Bacon sat in on the interview a little bit. You hear him piping up at one point. And next week's show, we will play your interview with Ed, leading up to the Northern Angling Show, which is pretty much all my focus at the minute. As you'll know from listening to previous podcasts, Roger Bacon and I have got permission to fish Kevin Nash's Copse Lake for the winter. We've fished it all winter. It's fished really slow. I think the last time we had fish was it end of November, early November maybe. We had a little mild spell and I had three fish, and there's been nothing out since then, like all winter. I'm in full flow for the Northern Angling Show now. It's the time of year where I am the most stressed. If I still had hair, then it would have been pulled out over the past week. We're recording this now, and I'm shooting straight back to Manchester for more meetings and stuff. But Roger is fishing. He had four fish last week, and I haven't dared ring him this morning, but he was up to seven, I think, this morning. In a lake that holds a handful of fish, I must add. There are not many fish in the Copse Lake. Kevin's got restocking plans. He's got a new lake up there, and there's different bits and bobs going on. And basically, when these fish get caught, they are going into the new lake. So it's basically, you know, if Roger caught the big one today, then I will not have a chance to fish for it. Well, certainly not for a few years, maybe. I'm kind of sat at the minute frustrated, knowing that Roger's absolutely hauling. But the interesting thing of how he's hauling, he was on the Copse last week, and somebody he knows from back in the day in the 80s that he used to go fishing with had actually booked the Church Lake. Him and this other chap and a friend were on. They had a slow start to the week, ended up fishing zigs, and ended up with, I might have this wrong, but they ended up with a lot of fish, like 9 or 10 fish or something, including the 4x4 at 50 something, 52 I think it was. So obviously, Roger had done a couple of days on the Copse. It was absolutely dead. He'd started seeing signs of fish, and, you know, fish near the surface and whatever. But being a reluctant zig angler, same as myself, he hadn't put a zig on. He did, and then caught four fish in the next 36 hours. He's obviously gone back this week full of beans, and has now had seven, including one of the big ones, the DVD fish that I had last March at 48. He's had it at quite a low weight, was shot at 44, which shows what a crap winter it's been. The fish haven't been feeding. In fact, we might as well speak to Roger mid-session. Might as well speak to him right now. So you're having a pretty mega session. Are you converted to the zigs at last?
Well, yeah, as you know, I'm not really a man that's been heavily into zigs over the years. I mean, I've had a few fish on zigs in the past. I remember having quite a good session on Christchurch years ago. So, you know, I do know how effective they can be, but I don't know, it seems like the anglers of our sort of age, you know, what you might call the old school anglers, it's not the go-to method this year. You sort of persevere and persevere on bottom baits, and then maybe a lad down the way or someone you know, across the other side is has caught a fish on zigs, and you eventually sort of, or I'll put one out and just see how I get on. That's really what happened on, is it a few weeks ago now, that me and you was on here, and Spenny and Reedy were fishing?
Yeah, Spenny and Reedy were on the Church Lake, and Reedy had a couple on zigs, didn't he? Spenny kind of caught one on a zig.
kind of caught one, yeah. But what I'm saying is, I mean, that week, you know, there was, I don't know, what did they have, 8 or 10 fish out between them, and probably 3/4 of them were all on zigs, weren't they? Especially for Reedy, he was catching kind of consistently on him.
Yeah. So even then,
you know, the zig talk was like, well, you know, it looks like they're having it on zigs, maybe I should be trying that. And then I came back, I think about a week later, and just by chance, there was a lad on here, the lad on the Church again, that I've not seen for 20 years. He was fishing, and him and his mate had probably about another 10 fish out that week, and they were all caught on zigs. And I was fishing the Copse at the time, and I did two days on bottom baits, just fishing as you would. And obviously watching them catch, I thought, up in for the penny, in for the pound. The last 3 days of that session, I'm going to put all my rods on zigs. I'm fishing right through. And I ended up going from having no bites in the first 2 days on bottom baits to getting 5 bites in the last 3 days on zigs. So, you know, obviously, it was like, right, next time I come back, I'm straight in on the zigs.
Which is this session. And what's happened this session?
Yeah, which is this session. Come back this session. It's been a bit exit, really. I've basically had bites any time, day, night. I've had 7 bites. I think I've had 7 bites off zigs, landing 5 fish. But I have kept one rod on a bottom bait rod, and I've had 2 fish on the bottom bait rods. Don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but the 2 biggest fish I've fell to the bottom baits. I've had a 28 and a 44.6 off the bottom bait rods, which is, you know, brilliant in itself. But what's more sort of intriguing is the zigs. You know, I've had 5 fish on zigs, 7 bites, 5 fish on the zigs, and they've all been these, I mean, you'll know, these so-called uncatchable smaller fish that are in the Copse. Everyone knows there, but they just never seem to get caught. I don't know what your thinking is on that. Why? I don't know. They just seem to be, whether it's the coming into contact with the zig for the first time and it's completely catching them out. What do you think?
Well, we're on about these small fish in the Copse. They've never been stocked. They're bred in there. People have known they've been in there for quite a few years now. Alan Blair tried catching them out of maggots quite a few years ago, and he said they were super hard to catch even then. You know, he was having to pull the maggots out of the way of the big 50s because, you know, as soon as they saw that, they were grabbing it. And these small ones were, like, really tricky to catch. Now, then they were like doubles. Now these fish are 20s up to, I think, 28's the biggest you've had so far. Now, these are fish that have bred in the lake in the last few years and have grown. So they're all sons and daughters of the big ones, but I don't know if it's just because they're at a size now where you know, they just hit a certain weight and they become more catchable. They're less scared. They're, you know, they're not timid young things anymore. They're a bit more bold and confident. I don't know. The interesting thing for me is, and I've heard this a lot of times with zigs. Now I know many examples of big fish being caught on zigs. You know, the 50s out of places like Bluebell get caught on the zigs. I know Christchurch, some of the good ones have been caught on the zigs, but they seem to be the exception to the rule. Most lakes I know that see a lot of zig fishing, you catch the small ones on the zigs, and if you want to catch the big ones, you catch them on the bottom. And I've come across that many times on many different lakes where you'll just catch all the pasties fish. And was it like that on the Essex Manor? Did you sort of catch like the 30s and below on the zigs, and then if you wanted to catch a kipper, you know, you weren't going to catch one of the big ones on a zig.
Yeah, definitely. It did have that sort of pattern on there. I mean, I went on there again, never fished. I mean, that's a really deep pit, about 28 foot in some places, and you know, it's all within 20, 30 yards of the bank what you're fishing. So you learn to fish adjustable zigs on there in deep water. And again, I had a lot of fish out of there, but no big ones. It was all that, you know, 20 to 30, maybe 35 if you was lucky. But getting back to these fish that are in here, the smaller ones, I mean, like you say, maybe they've just got to a certain size where they're now catchable. I mean, you know, last year when the lake was fished, you know, not far off constantly, you know, they were pretty much the same size as what they are now, but they still never got caught off the bottom. They were just...
Yeah, I had a few though. I did two sessions last winter, one in January and one at the end of February, first week in March, and both times I had three or four of those stockies, you know, ones, well, yeah, we call them stockies, but ones that have grown. I had one big one and three or four of the other ones, and they were all off the bottom. So I don't know why it fished a bit moody last summer. I mean, there weren't a lot of fish out, was there? You know, I had as many fish in those two sessions in January and February as what the entire lake did for the rest of the summer, pretty much.
To well, according to Alan and Kevin, there was what was it, eight fish caught between April and the end of September off the lake.
Yeah, the thing that's amazing me is how many of these fish are in there, because I don't think anybody knew. I mean, I know what we've taken, because obviously these fish are not going back in the lake, so they're only ever getting caught once, that they're all completely uncaught, because if they'd have been caught, they'd have been took out and put into one of the stock ponds on the complex. So, I've taken seven or eight out. You've took more than that out now, I would have thought. In fact, I might have had more than 10, actually, because...
Yeah, I think in the last two sessions, I've probably had about eight in the last two sessions that I've been taking. I had one, that first session last year, there was one that was removed then. So, you know, it's probably at least 20 just between us two.
Yeah, and then Alan told me there was 20, 25 before that.
Yeah.
You know, that had been just took out by people that had fished it over the last couple of years. So, I mean, the mirrors seem quite rare as well, which is interesting. Like, we have had a few of, like, the 20-pound mirrors, which are obviously ones that are bred in there, but 80-90% of them are commons, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, of all the fish I've had, the first one I had last year was a mirror, and I've had a mirror on the last session of the fully scaled mirror. That was about 25 pounds. But these fish, I mean, they're getting... Well, I've just seen a fish show, actually. Looking out the window in the lodge onto the church, and the fish has just jumped by the island. But these fish, you know, they're what was I saying, the mirrors are definitely sort of one in every 10, maybe even more fish are the mirrors, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you've had what, 9 bites this session, landed 7? I mean, how long have you got left?
I've got another 24 hours from now. I had a decent fish yesterday. Obviously, you know about that one. It was 44.6. It has been 50. Kevin's looking at a picture of it now, actually, with Kevin read it when it was 50. You had it last March, was it at 48?
Yeah.
I had that fish yesterday from down one end of the lake. Had to get in the boat. The lake is really weedy at the moment. Siltweed, black, stinking siltweed. And once you get a fish in it, it's super hard to get out. So I had a 45-minute battle with a fish that I never thought I was going to get in. But I did. And then, obviously, after distressing that end of the lake out so much, I actually thought about going home at one stage. I thought, right, that's it. You know, nothing's going to happen now. But I thought, right, well, if I do stay, I'll move and I'll fish up the other end just before you get to the shallow end, the deep water there. And it was there that I put a couple of zigs last night. And one of them went, half 3 in the morning. That was another 18-pound coming. So yeah, the zig fishing, I am converted 100%. It will not be sort of second choice in future. It might even start to become first choice.
Except it does seem to be smaller fish. If you want bites, then it seems to be the method.
Yeah, it is. A bologna, it seems to be singling out the smaller fish. You know, and I fished them at different depths. I've fished zigs on the clear spots that we've fished in the past. You know, the clear spots that feel like gravel, but they're not the clay. That we've had bottom bait bites off in the past. I've had a couple of bites off them sort of areas, but only if I put a low zig on them areas and keep it, you know, within 2 or 3 foot of the bottom, I get a bite off them. The bites where I've had, the zigs where I've had bites and have been higher up in the water, I've had to drop it sort of onto weed, you know, weed that might be coming up 2 or 3 foot in 7 foot of water. So I've fished a 4 foot zig sort of coming out of the weed there, and I managed to get pickups from them sort of places. But yeah, it's been good. Been putting the old sweetness on it, you know, the tangleberry that Reedy did quite well on last time.
For those of you who don't know, Nash do typical story is what happens a lot in the fishing industry is you get onto a really good flavour or bait, and then for one reason or another, whether it's commercial reason or because stocks run out or whatever, then things vanish. And then we've just, I hadn't used a tangleberry before. It's like a thick, sweet liquid that Nash do. It's quite similar to the sticky sweet that DNA do, isn't it? Which they yeah. advertise for Ziggs.
It's very similar to the sticky sweet, which, I mean, I used that a few years ago in Christchurch, and it was very good. You know, I caught plenty on it. It is a bit thicker. This tangleberry is a bit thicker. It does seem a bit sweeter. But yeah, I've been soaking my straightforward black foam in that, and then just before I'd put it on, I'd get my forceps, cut my foam to size, get my forceps, put my foam, sort of dunk my foam under the liquid, and then squeeze it, my forceps, you know, squeeze it three or four times like you would a sponge underneath, you know, in your bath. Yeah. So squeezing the water in, squeezing the water out. I've done that. Whether that makes any difference, I don't know. So just
must be sucking in, mustn't it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely sucking in. I mean, even after the Ziggs have been out for overnight, and I might think, right, I'm just going to reposition that. You know, I wind it in, and you've got weed, siltweed around it. But as I'm taking the siltweed off, I'm tasting the siltweed, and the siltweed tastes sweet. It's definitely still there, and that's 12 hours after it had been out from the night before. But on the other hand, you know, doing that squeezing sort of thing, I've put my Ziggs out, and I've had a bite within a couple of hours. So obviously, you know, whether that's attracting him or I don't know, but they definitely like it, and I'll be getting some more.
Yeah, Kevin, when you listen to this, please don't stop selling the tangleberry. I heard a rumour that you know, they're discontinuing it because nobody's been buying it, but to be honest, I hadn't really heard of it until I saw Reedy's part of it, and now we've started using it, the result seems to be pretty damn good on it. So I'm going to make it my mission to make sure people are aware of it, and hopefully they'll keep doing it, because it does seem to be, well, you've had bites very quickly, haven't you, after recharging your Ziggs and stuff, so.
Yeah, I just call it, yeah, I like reboosting and squeezing it and reloading them up with the tangleberry and then swinging them out, and yeah, I've had bites within a couple of hours, so, I mean, if it does get discontinued, as you say, I'm going to make it my mission to get myself a litre of it, and make sure I've got a future stash of it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, please don't stop selling it, Kevin. We'll help market it for you. Yeah, so it's turned into a pretty epic session. I did say after, you know, you'd had five or six bites that you were going to get a big one. The big one's come off the bottom. I don't particularly want you catching another big one just yet till I can get back on.
Well, I think there's one more big one, one bigger near that you've had that you wouldn't mind me catching, so we'll see. I don't know, I've got a feeling it's slowing down now. You know, I've caught a few fish and the lake's been disturbed quite a bit, but and it has got cold, you know, the conditions have completely changed. I mean, when I was getting bites up to yesterday, the water temperature was 10.5 when I got here, and up until sort of yesterday afternoon, it had rose to 12. So obviously the water's on the rise. I've not checked it yet today, but we've had completely different conditions overnight. It's cleared. We've got plenty of sun at the minute, so I'll be climbing a few trees in the next couple of hours. But the wind has changed. The wind is cold, so I'll be looking back at the wind, climbing a few trees, and see what happens for me last 24 hours.
Yeah, well, best of luck. I hope you keep catching them 20 pounders, and they're saving the big ones for me.
All right, mate. Cheers. I'll keep you informed.
So, big thank you to Roger. I just feel a little bit sick inside, but I'm just putting it out of my mind until I get a chance to go fishing, which Lord knows when. There's a slim possibility I can get there towards the end of this week and fish the weekend, but I don't know. But yeah, so we were talking about the Northern Angling Show. That comes up in on the 1st and 2nd of April, which is just under 2 weeks now. It's getting pretty close. You're there, are you, Mark, on the weekend?
Oh, yes, I'll be there. I'll be there on both days. I'm sure it'll be busy. I'm looking forward to seeing it because you've extended it. You've got more room.
Yeah, it's very, very, very large this year. Double the size, in fact. The most, obviously, there are millions and millions of companies there. And I spoke to Ali Hamidi earlier, actually, who is going to give us a little bit heads up about what to expect from them guys. Got a new series of The Big Fish Off out now. Did you have you caught any of them yet, Mark? Have you got them on record?
I've got it recorded, not watched it yet. I've, my time is precious, but I will be doing it after The Walking Dead.
Yeah, looking forward to see the Ricky Hatton one. I used to know Ricky Hatton many years ago. He used to come in the place I worked in Blackpool almost weekly. He was in there a lot with the lads. And spent quite. He used to love a drink. Did Ricky many years ago? I'm sure he still does now. With him being Manchester, and with Ali being in town, I wonder if he might end up at the Northern Angling Show. We shall find out from Ali in a short while. A little chat with him, but yeah, all the usual stuff there. There are millions of companies, pretty much everybody. I believe your companies you work with are all there, Mark, aren't they?
Yes, JRC will be there. I'll be popping over to say hello to those every now and then.
Yeah, you're going to be on the Carpcast stand as well. Carpcast has got a stand along, like a double stand with VIP Carp Holidays. On it, you'll be able to come and we're going to be selling all the Carpcast clothing, aren't we? We're going to have an extra special sale price on all of that at the show. So if you want to get yourself a Carpcast hat, hoodie, t-shirt, we shall be we shall have plenty of those with us, being expertly displayed by ourselves. Are we, Mark? You're going to come fully kitted up, or are you going to wear your camo like you normally do at shows?
I'm offended. I will be wearing probably wearing jeans and a Carpcast t-shirt.
Yeah, we don't do any Carpcast pants as yet. But yeah, come down, have a chat with us, be able to get the Knowledge DVDs on there, be able to have a chat with Mark and myself about anything you'd like. Come and find the Carpcast stand. And there's a couple of cancellations just come in for VIP Carp Holidays. I'll just get that up as we're talking, but we book like family holidays, and we've got two fantastic venues, one on the River Lot in the south of France. It's a fair way down. It's a villa, a beautiful villa with a swimming pool that sleeps up to 8 people. You've got your own private 70 metres of fishing bank. It's a non-flood area, so if you've never fished a river in France before, then it's the perfect way to start, because it's fishable like all times of year. It's it doesn't flood in that particular area. Everything's provided, like boats and motors. You can take your own tackle, or you can hire all everything you need there. If you decide to fly and don't want to take everything, all your bed chairs and bivvies and all the heavy stuff, it's run but and owned by Jim Lightfoot, who's a fantastic European angler. He is an expert of the continent, and we've got bait and everything over there. It's done catfish to over £100, carp to £60 in that stretch. There's big everything. There's some good predator fishing there, the Zander, big Zander and pike, and it's perfect for the family, absolutely perfect for the family, because you've got the villa, it's in a nice area of France, and it's just way, you know, perfect for the kids, family. There's like bikes provided, there's a games room in there, you know, table tennis table, all sorts of other stuff, and it's just perfect if you want to combine a family holiday with a fishing holiday, somewhere very warm in the south of France. And again, you can be picked up from the airport, they do transfers, make it as pleasant as you can, and it's pretty much fully booked. There was a couple of weeks left in 2017 and we're taking bookings for 2018, but Jim messaged me the other day, so a couple of cancellations come in, one which is 15th to the 22nd of April, which is coming up soon, but it's Easter week, and it's only £800 for that week. There's another free week on the 6th to the 13th of May, which is £1,000 in May, and the first 3 weeks in October are available, which are only £800 a week in October, and October is one of the best fishing months there is out there. So yeah, it's a villa, it's perfect for you know, a couple of mates, or a family, or two families you could even get in there, and £800 a week for a week in October. in the south of France, red hot, all the facilities there, games room and everything. It's absolutely perfect. We also have a week available in April in, in fact, the first 2 weeks in April at our other venue at VIP Carp Holidays, which is St. Amand. You might know we had some reviews of St. Amand from Ben Smethurst last year, who is back out again this year. It's a farmhouse, sleeps 10 people near Limoges in France. It's got its own 4.5 acre lake, which is very, very, very well stocked with carp. It's carp to £50, loads of 40s, tons of 20s and 30s. It's the sort of place you don't really need to fish at night. You can catch 8 or 10 fish a day and then spend the evenings with the families if you want. Obviously you can just go on a serious fishing holiday, fishing all the time and catch literally hundreds of carp if you wanted to, but it's perfect. There's all sorts of other species in there, but excuse me, my cough's almost gone. But perfect to take the kids, you know, they'll be catching on the float and ledger, and there's just lots of everything in there. But it's primarily a heavily stocked carp water. And again, there's a games room, table tennis table, loads of outdoor games in a beautiful 200-year-old farmhouse. It's got, you know, it's got satellite TV, English satellite TV, and all the facilities you could ever need for a fishing holiday. If you go to vipcarpholidays.com, you can have a look on there, or get in touch with myself on Facebook or the VIP Carp Holidays page on Facebook, or come and see us at the Northern Angling Show, because we will be there. So yeah, come and do that. What else is going on at the show? There is a band playing, which is our band that we've put together, a band known as the Masturbators, which is us, myself, Clive Gibbons, Sam Toro, Paul Sewell and Paul Wild. We had a rehearsal last week, Mark. It was quite entertaining. we attempted to learn our set, and however that goes with the carp group, there will be Clive Gibbons' band, his proper band, that actually know what they're doing, straight afterwards. And I spoke to Clive just a few minutes ago, so I'd like to welcome Mr. Clive Gibbons to the Carpcast. How are we this morning, Clive?
I'm very well indeed, Jamie, thank you. I'm currently in Rotherham at one of my shops doing my job.
You work in the fishing industry, obviously. Do you work for Tracker and Corder, is it?
Yeah, I've represented Tracker and Corder for over 20 years. I'm a sales agent.
Yeah.
So I basically travel around the retail tackle shops in the north of England, representing their goods, along with my my eldest son works for me as well.
So that's how you know everybody in the fishing industry. You've been doing it a long time, haven't you, I think?
Yeah, 23 years, I think, I've been doing this job now.
Wow. And you're known for being a musician in the carp scene and out of the carp scene. You have your own band, haven't you? You've been playing for a long time.
Yeah, I've been drumming since I was 11, basically, in bands on and off over the years. Some might say a musician, but I'm actually a drummer, so I don't know if that counts, does it?
Cue all the drummer jokes. there are plenty.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
What is it about drummers being the butt of the musician jokes? Is it just because they bang things? Why is it?
I think so, yeah. What's the usual one? Look at him, he's building a shed and all that, you get on that thing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so you playing? I know you used to play in an AC/DC band, didn't you, for a while?
Yeah. I formed probably the biggest AC/DC tribute going these days is a band called Livewire.
Yeah.
I started that in 1998. I can't quite remember when I packed in doing it, but I just got a bit fed up of every weekend living in a transit van, staying in travel lodges. Terrific fun and great crack with the lads, but it just became a bit monotonous, I think, after a while. It wasn't a career, it was a bit of fun. But they've gone on to be absolutely huge.
Yeah.
Fantastic band.
I had a similar experience. I lived out of a van for 7 years. We had, you know, the bulkhead in and a couple of bunk beds. And it's not, it's, you know, we didn't earn enough money to be having travel lodges. It was driving to the gig, driving from and trying to sleep where you could. But 4 or 5 nights a week, it takes a toll. And then I think you get to an, it's so much fun, but you get to an age where, like, you've got family and you can't live can't live like that, can you, forever, I don't think.
Absolutely, yeah. And the staple diet of, like, Burger King and Red Bull, you know, it's just like... good fun. I don't regret it. I enjoyed it, and I kind of thought I'd retired from the drumming, and next thing you know, I think it's in the blood. It's a bit like the fishing. It's in there, and it wants to come out, and you go and see another band play in a pub or something, you think, I'd rather be up there doing it than listening to it.
So
I'm still at it.
I did it for a job for many years, and stopped, as you know, for probably 12 years. I didn't pick up an instrument, and then after a chat with Lee Jackson and meeting yourself and the other lads down at a charity carp function in Essex, exactly the same thing that you've just said happened. It was just like, oh, this is quite good fun, and I enjoy it, and I want to play again, you know.
Absolutely, and here
we are. So off the back of that, we did the charity group for, well, first of all, tell us, how did the Carp Society group come about? Where did that first appear?
How it quite came about, I can't quite remember. I think the first thing we played was probably at one of the shows at Dunstable. Carp Society show back in Dunstable, Queen's Hall, back in whenever, a long, long time ago. Liam Jackson, myself, unfortunately the late Chrissy Haswell was singing, my mate Andy Boulder sadly passed away as well 4 years ago today, terrific guitarist, all Carp fishermen as well, Terry Cheeseman, he's still, as you met Terry, didn't you, the last event we did, we got Chris Ball involved, and it's great fun, and I think people just enjoyed seeing, you know, personalities they only saw as carp fishermen doing something a little bit different. Good fun.
Do you remember all the songs you played back then?
I could probably play them tomorrow, Purple Rain by Prince, we did Walking by Gary Moore, probably Highway to Hell, I think. Rocking Over the World by Quo, we did that, and I think Lee decided it would be Carping All Over the World, which was quite a good idea. So yeah, it was fun, enjoyed it.
And winding on, we have, obviously I was a bit inspired after seeing that and seeing you guys do it down in Essex. We've now have a new era. Lee was going to be a part of it, but I think the logistics have worked out too difficult with him being the opposite end of the country. So it's ended up being a more Manchester flavoured band. We now have the Northern Carp Group. You won't know this yet, but we do have a name now.
Hit me with it.
We were going to go down the serious route or the funny route, and we went through all the mongers and choddy waddy and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We are officially the Master Baiters.
That'll do. quite apt, I think, don't you?
I think it's a I went through a few with Sam yesterday morning, and that was the one that seemed everybody went, ooh, yeah.
So
we are the Master Baiters. It consists of yourself on drums, obviously, myself on whittling guitar. We have the two Pauls playing, singing and bass, and Sam Toro, who some people will know, or you may know from Trafford Anglim, and you used to visit there.
Yeah, Absolutely, I've known Sam for donkey's years. He still looks like a young boy, doesn't he?
he's never aged a day. You're right.
No. He's been in the fountain of youth, I think.
Sam, I met him through fishing, and we became friends. Went out clubbing a few times, and he used to come up to my bar in Blackpool. But he's a very accomplished musician. He's been in a number of bands over the years, and thankfully works at Salford Uni, that has some amazing studios, which allowed us to practice in the other day. So
yeah, that was,
go on,
that was a real eye opener, I've got to say.
Yeah, it's, at least it's not taxpayers' money anymore. It's it's because of the government. They pay what, nine grand a year for the course. So because of that, have the most amazing equipment and facilities. So yeah, it was good. Are you feeling confident? We know the songs now.
You know we won't know the songs. No, I'm kidding. We'll be fine. We'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah,
we'll be fine. We'll rock it, as they say.
Yes, we'll be rocking all over Manchester, I guess. We're not doing rocking all over the world, are we? So.
No, we're not. We'll leave the songs as a bit of a surprise.
Yes, yeah, no spoilers. So the script is, we'll be playing around 5 o'clock on the Saturday of the Northern Angling Show, 1st of April. You're coming up in the morning. Are you going to do a bit on any of the stands? You're going to get all carpet on us?
I'm going to come down probably about lunchtime, but I'll be mainly carrying heavy equipment into the hall, I think. but I will be mingling, of course, and there'll be loads of people down there that I haven't seen for a long time, so that'll be good.
Yeah.
Have a chat.
I bet it's a while since you've been to a carp show, is it?
The fact that I'm pausing means, yes, it is. It is a long time.
Yeah, well,
I've been to most of them over the years, you know. So I've been to the ones at Broads, Waller, and things like that in the past.
Well, I'm sure you'll enjoy the atmosphere of the Manchester Carp Show, because we're in our fifth show now, but just the excitement of you know, the customers coming. It's not like there's been six shows in the South every year for the last 20 years. You know, it's still very new, and you know, we've got people like Danny Fairbrass there this year, has never been there before. You know, every year there's people that the anglers haven't seen, and there is a buzz about it.
Yeah.
There's a definite buzz about it. So.
Absolutely. I think the timing's right as well, isn't it? It's if you leave it too late, they're all going to want to go fishing, which is understandable, but. The northern weather, I think it's good timing, because I think somebody's just said this morning we're going to get some snow this week.
Joking.
Oh my god.
our very first show 4.5 years ago was the last weekend in March. It was our entry show as a northern show in Manchester, and we had 2.5 foot of snow on the Saturday morning on the last week in March.
Nice.
And every single motorway into Manchester was shut. M61, M62, the M6 coming north, they were all shut. I was just like, oh, please no. So yeah, don't.
It's grim up north, lad.
I'm touching wood as we speak to make sure we don't have snow in 2 weeks. It was all.
Yeah.
It was all fine around the Trafford Centre. Obviously, it's a very busy area. The facilities around Manchester are amazing. It was just getting to Manchester that was the tough bit. Well, so we're on stage. We're going to be having a few beers, no doubt. There will be fun and frivolities.
I'm really looking forward to it. Be nice. I'll enjoy it.
And after the Masturbators is a professional band, i.e. your own band. It's Dark Skies, am I right?
Yeah, Dark Skies. It's a 5-piece band, and we play rock covers, AC/DC, that kind of thing. Thin Lizzy, ZZ Top, Deep Purple, Boston. You get the idea.
I'm looking forward to it.
Get the drift of what we play. Yeah. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. We're going to play about an hour, I think. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, be really good. be really good.
Fantastic. So, yeah.
And there's something a little bit different, Jamie, isn't it? Something a little bit different.
It is. We're trying to develop the social side of the shows. That was one of the things that always appealed to me years ago in the early days. It was not just about seeing the latest equipment, you know, learning stuff, watching the talks from people like Danny and stuff, but it was just meeting up with people you used to fish with on syndicates maybe a few years ago, and once a year you have an annual piss up basically, and we're trying to recreate that environment, put some entertainment on. We've got DJ as well, playing sort of pretty cool disco-y house edits and stuff, just well-known stuff. Fraser Todd is a friend of mine's coming down. There's going to be two bands. We've got the bar going on in there. There'll be a little bit of a happy hour, be some food, and we hope everybody comes down and enjoys it on the Saturday.
Yeah, make sure they're all wearing denim and leather, of course.
I'm going to have to get a wig. The last time I played guitar in a band, I had long hair. Fortunately, living on the seafront in Blackpool, there are millions and millions of little stands that sell like Rod Stewart wigs and, you know what?
Yeah, get one.
Yeah, I think I'm there.
bullet belts and bandanas are optional, but denim and leather is... mandatory.
Fantastic. I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks, and let's get practicing. I probably need it.
Yeah, you go back to your guitar and keep learning those songs.
My fingers are still bleeding from the other days. I was going to name the group Bleeding Hands and after that practice session, but cool. I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
You too, fella. All the best.
So a big thank you to Clive, and if we mess it up, then at least Clive's band can do it properly. Do you see Clive in your shop on his repping duties?
We don't know. No, it goes to our Rotherham HQ, I believe, and they do all our. I think he does a corder and tracker. We've got a different tracker rep who does pop in, Gary.
Yeah.
But all our corder stuff, it's like an automatic computerised reorder system, which works really well, to be fair. As long as we keep a stock right and keep an eye on it, it's good.
Hmm. Yeah, how's the shop going this time of year? Are all the keen little carpers out there buying the gear for the coming season?
Oh yeah, it's picking up. It's not just carpers, it's a lot of people. I've been doing the elasticate poles lately.
Really? But yeah, obviously the rivers and stuff have shut now, haven't they?
Yeah, rivers have closed. But it's about this time of year, a lot of your club matches start again.
Right.
So everyone's getting ready for that, but certainly on the carp side, you know, we've managed to it's a big shop, but again, it's not. I'd like it twice as big, to be honest, and we could have bivvies up and everything. But, we do quite well. Can't complain.
I actually went fishing last week. We had the carp cast. Trip to John Max Lake, Etang de Bernier, in the Champagne region of France. We knew it was going to be a gamble going early in the year. Obviously, it's middle of March. John doesn't normally open till April, but obviously, with other commitments, we and the fact that he's nearly fully booked for this year, we decided to take a group of lads, and what a top group of lads they were. We had a lad that I know, Paul Bowers from Manchester, one of Roger's friends. He jumped on last minute. We had a couple of lads from Cumbria, Jason and Lee, who were super keen. We had two younger lads, I forget where they're from, but Nick and Ian came. And Rich, you know, from Fired Up Barbecues. .co.uk, who used to do all the or still does and will be doing this year on our Carpcast socials, who does the barbecues, fantastic food. Rich came and unfortunately didn't bring his barbecue gear, but he also brought Matt, who you know, used to come on the used to come with Rich on the socials that we've done. A top group of lads we had. John Mack was as crazy as ever. I've never known anybody drive a transit van so fast. I watched him broadside a tractor at 120 miles an hour in the middle of France on the wrong side of the road. When we all met at the Channel Tunnel, John was like, right, what speed do you all drive at normally? And everyone was like, 80 miles an hour, maybe 90. He went, 80 or 90. He was like, mate. He went, well, I drive really fast, so you're going to have to keep up. Anyway, 90 was probably the bottom speed that he did at any point. The lowest end. There was another chap was saying, I've got the same transit as yours, and mine doesn't go that fast, so I don't know what he's done to it, but oh my goodness. But the bright side of that is we got there in absolutely record time. We're in a convoy all the way through France to his lakes, about 240 miles from Calais, Tang de Bernier. And we seemed to get there in no time with a Burger King stop. The weather was a bit funny. It was very nice in the daytimes. It was varied between sort of 16 and 20 degrees in the day, which was quite nice. Got a little bit of colour on my bald head. I was actually on the cold side of the lake. They only got a bit of sun because of the trees, but the lads that were on the side that got the sun all day were extremely tanned by the end of the week. But the downside to that, you know what happens at this time of year when you've got not a cloud in the sky and sun all day?
Cold nights.
Very cold nights, yeah. We had a frost pretty much every night, and I think that like 20 degree temperature shift every day upset the fishing. There were 9 fish caught and a couple lost, which is not great between 9-10 anglers on a week in France. It's not fantastic, but it was a grueler. It was an absolute grueler. I came out last in the draw, and I ended up having a few fish, which was pretty good. I had a few up to 41 pound. I had the biggest common carp I've ever seen for like weight to size ratio. This thing was ridiculous. It was 2-3 inches wider than the net, you know, like the width of the net. It took me 3 goes to get it in the net after I'd thought it was a bream and tried to shake it off. I've done that before, if you remember.
You have.
Yeah, I've done it a couple of times. You know, when they're quite often some big fish, they just shake their head at the start and it just feels a bit breamy. And I didn't actually catch any bream. I did have a couple drop off. Well, I hope they're a bream. So a couple of the other lads did catch a bream or two. I'm sure you'd have had one or two if you'd have been on there, Mark. But,
what are you saying?
The bream specialist. But yeah, this fish, I was actually watching, it was Wednesday night last week, I was watching Derek the Don's live stream on Facebook Live, and I got a drop back. I was fishing to like a far margin. It was like a spit that came up the middle of the lake, and it was about 80, 90 yards away, 20, 25 wraps, and you could fish to bushes. In hindsight, that was probably, I think the majority of the carp that got caught were within a rod length or two of the bank. I know Rich had one on the first day, and that was up his right hand margin. I think he might have lost one up his right hand margin as well. Matt did get a couple of bites out of open water, but Matt, when he moved later in the week, when the fish vanished, he did find some fish in the edge and ended up getting a bite one evening. And only Jason had a fish out the margin, and all mine were out the margin bar one. I had one that was about 30 yards off the bank, but the majority of them were, so out of like 9 fish caught, 7 of them were within a rod length of the bank, which I think is quite telling. They wanted to be in the shallower water, basically, because the average depths of the lake was sort of 10 to 12 foot, I would say. So the majority of the fish came out the margins, which is something I actually learned on a French trip many years ago when I went to Nash's Cavagnac Lake. That was exactly the same conditions. It was later in the year when we went, but it's up in the Pyrenees, that lake. I think David runs it now. Cavagnac fishing is cracking lake, by the way. In fact, Reedy's going in after the fishing show, middle of April, so I can actually jump on that trip with him if I want. I think Cavagnac are going to be at the angling show, actually, at the Northern Angling Show, if you're there. But I think we ended up catching, between a group of us on that trip, we ended up catching 30 or 40 fish, It's the actual DVD that we made on the Knowledge, you know, the French Connection Knowledge DVD. That's the trip I'm talking about, if you've seen that. And basically, every single fish came out the margins. Like, it, you know, it took us most of the week to work it out, but, you know, out of 30, 40 bites and a very slow start to the week, they were all out the edge, pretty much every fish caught. And then I should have remembered that from this one. You know, I just picked this swim because it was one of the last swims and it just happened to have a far margin to cast to, and then it proved pretty good. But yeah, I was listening to Derek the Don, watching him do his shout outs on his Facebook Live thing, and I had a drop back as all the bites were on the far margin. It's felt like small, sort of shaking its head. I thought, is that a bream? And then it pulled a little bit. I was like, no, it's a carp. I actually went down, and I've got no shoes on at this point. I actually went down, sat on my bed, and still listening to Derek. With my other hand, I'm playing the fish in one hand. With the other hand, I'm typing a message to Derek Adon saying, I've just had a bite. Then, it's about nearly 100 yards across to the other side. So I'm just reeling it in, like, slowly. It's just coming towards me. And then it's probably, like, three quarters of the way in. And I was just like, I better put my shoes on now, I guess. I pulled my boots on and got my head torch. Stood up, went to the front of the swim. Caught a glimpse of the fish. I was like, oh, my God. I better try and land this because it looks big. It was very big. It was a common. It was like 41 and a half, something like that. But this fish had the biggest frame I've ever seen. It was wider than the landing net. And the landing net's, what, 42 inches at the front? And it was a good couple of inches each side of the net. So, you know, this fish must have been 45, 46 inches long, something like that, which is, what, 3.5 foot? 12, 20. No, it's nearly 4 foot, isn't it? 48 inches, 4 foot. And yeah, it was ridiculous. I mean, I the two biggest fish, there's a couple of 60s, there's 460s in the lake currently, and two of them are commons. I think it's like a 64 common, and I thought I'd caught one of the big ones. I put the shout out, you know, sent a message in our group to the lads that I've got a lump, because it was so big. I thought I'd caught a 50-60 pounder. I mean, it was the biggest fish of the trip, so it was an extremely nice capture. But it says to me, every fish I saw in that lake caught during the week had a huge frame. That lake is going to be one of the top lakes in the future. I mean, it's only down the road from Teliat's and Kevin Maddox's lakes and Castle Lakes, and you know, that area's got history for growing very big fish, and these are obviously a very good strain of carp that John's got in there. It's put a load of new fishing over the winter, and yeah, the lake itself really well spaced out. The swims, load of double swims and single swims. You've all got your own water. It's going to be one of the. I mean, I think John's had it 3 years now, so you know it's a quality lake now. But it's going to be right up there with the best lakes in France, I think, in a few years' time. The rate those fish are growing and the quality of fish they've got in there, highly recommend. Excuse me, still got a tiny tickly cough from the last show, but it's I'm definitely going back this year. Every single one of the lads said they want to go back, I think most of us are going to get back this year. Yeah, I'm gonna strongly recommend it. But yeah, it was nice that they were my first carp of 2017. Yeah, I hadn't caught one. Have you had one yet?
No.
Well,
I'm saving myself for a kipper.
You've got time today. What time are you packing up?
I've got till. Well, there's a 48-hour rule on here, so technically I've got time till about 5 o'clock this evening.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of moving, spending the day in a swim called the Swamp up the other end. But someone's in there. I'm just going to see how it plays off here. I'm in the shallow water swim. It's quite a cold wind blowing in at me at the minute, but if it warms up with this sun, there's a good chance of the fish appearing, so I'm going to tidy things up and just see how it goes. I've got things to do at home, so it's always good to get home and deal with things back in the real world, but you know, there's still time. My right hand rod's off to the right in slightly deeper water. If I had to put money on a rod going, it'd be that one more than any, to be honest. And I'm just looking at the A14 now. It's come to a standstill, which is why it's gone quieter. I like it like that.
I quite like the ambient noise in the background. It's just it's atmospheric, I think.
An atmospheric A14.
Yeah, well, people don't know it's the A14 until you ruined it. You could have been the sea, you know. You could have just been waves lapping in and.
No. Do you know what I have? I've discovered a way of actually combating it.
Yeah.
You drive 100 miles with Slayer on full blast, and when they get here, your ears are ringing that much you don't notice it. Perfect.
Well, I think we probably better get Gary Bays in then, because if you're looking for a swim move, maybe, then we need to free some time up. Reckon you'll get a move, or are you just going to pack up and go home?
I'm probably going to wait in here in this corner, to be honest. There's a good chance of him turning up, and where I fancy the move to is now occupied. And I've got some sausages to throw in the Ridge Monkey, that's more important.
Yeah, I've not eaten yet. It's 10 a.m. currently while we're recording this, so we started early doors, and yeah, my belly's hitting. I've still got some pan au chocolats left from France, so I might bank. They're pretty damn ace in the Ridge Monkey. Have you tried croissants or anything like that in the Ridge Monkey?
I've not, no, but they're full of gluten. But it reminds me, McVitie's.
Yeah.
You know, I've always been a fan of the Jaffa Cakes and actually angled for a McVitie's sponsorship.
Yeah.
But McVitie's now do gluten-free chocolate hobnobs.
Wow.
And screw you, McVitie's. £2.50 for 8 biscuits is taking advantage. Screw you, McVitie's. I will not buy another one of your products.
Wow.
Go to hell.
So, no more Jaffa Cakes?
No.
Okay. You heard it here first.
Out of principle, McVitie's can suck my stump.
Yeah, but selling gluten-free biscuits to a Yorkshireman at £2.50 a go is probably going to stop his love for Jaffa Cakes.
8 biscuits.
8?
There was 8 biscuits in the packet. That's what's annoyed me. I'm thinking, oh, great, they're catering for us. Yes.
Yeah.
Tufties. Told you. I'm just watching them. The only good thing about these Tufties at the minute is that seagulls dive bombing them at the same time.
I tell you what, though.
Both back down.
I have had, we've spoke about this before, but I've had many fish pick my bait up when...
Yeah, I have as well, which is why I'm just not doing anything. I might recast if they've been away, nothing's happened for about 10 minutes, but... I've caught so many fish under ducks.
I don't want to spoil for Gary Bays's interview, but we do actually discuss this a little bit. Like, things that can create competition for the carp to actually pick your bait up. I mean, you're in a lake where you're probably not very far from many carp, are you? There's a lot. You're fishing a lake that's got a lot of carp, so the problems are different. Well, the problems are, you know, getting them to feed on your spot. Like, you know, it's a different set of problems to fishing a lake where maybe location is the most important thing. I mean, location is always important because fish, even no matter how big the lake and how many fish are in there, they move around. But there's no way that you're going to do a 48-hour session in any swim on that lake and not have fish come across you at some point during that session. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. It was the same on the Folly last year, but yeah, it was a small lake. You had to make the most of that small window when you had the fish on you. Well, I think in here, you know, there's a bigger stock per acre because it's only about the same size as Cromwell when you're down here.
What I'm getting at is sometimes it can be something else that induces the fish to feed, such as, you know, if a fish is swimming by and a duck picks up your boilie and then drops it, sometimes that can be enough for the fish to go, oh, you little git, that's mine, you know, like, just it creates a bit of competition. I've had that, and we do talk about that with Gary coming up, and he's got another method of doing exactly that. Can you think what it might be, of sort of recreating, or it's something we used to do in float fishing a lot, and that's just move it. Like, tweak it. And how many carp anglers do that, actually tweak the bait?
Well, it helps. A lot of time we're fishing bottom baits, bottom rigs, and you think, oh, if I move it, I'm going to smell the hook in a bit of weed or something.
Well, I've listened to Gary's views on that coming up, and I think that's time for us to say goodbye and to say hello to Mr. Gary Bays.
one of our most requested guests we finally have here today, and it's Nash Bates, Mr. Gary Bates. How are we doing, Gary?
All right, mate. All right.
Good. Well, we've already started chatting, and some gems of wisdom have been coming out already, so we'll try and go over that stuff again. But I want to go back to the early days. We've spoke with Kevin quite a lot on this podcast, and Rod Hutchinson comes up quite a bit, and you started working with Rod, didn't you? That was the early Bay days.
Yeah, I used to live and fish in the Lincoln area, and so I knew Rod through fishing. My ex-wife started working for him, he got busier, I ended up working for him, and I always got on well with him, and he's the best man at my first wedding.
Was he?
Yeah.
And that was you went to work for him doing bait. Had you already been messing about with bait yourself?
I'd already been making bait. I can remember years ago, was on, I think, the Lakeside Lido. And Rod was one side with his paste, and I was the other side with my paste, and it was almost like, he caught one, I caught one, he caught one, I caught one, and we just about ended up even, except for Rod didn't weigh his nor way bigger than mine somehow or another.
He was competitive, was he, even back then?
Yeah.
So, you've obviously been making bait a long time, and this is, what sort of year is this you're talking about?
I didn't start carp fishing until I was fairly late, in my early 20s. Mm. So
50 years?
About 30 years ago, 33 years ago. And bearing in mind at Lincoln area, there's lots of waters, we weren't really sure even if there was a carp in them. I was fishing for just three fish in a little pond or something like that, so it wasn't easy, and I failed a lot, to be honest, because you're still learning, aren't you? They're not the sort of waters to learn on. Imagine throwing somebody on fen baiting now who hadn't really caught many doubles even in the 20s.
Would it? So have you seen what we know about, we've got technology behind us now and we've learned stuff and there's research and all sorts, how much has it changed? What you think needs to go in a boilie compared to what you knew then 30 years ago?
The main important thing, what I've always had on my mind, I'm not a scientist, is you want to be using things what they want to eat. Yeah. So I've always, with all the different ingredients what I've ever used, I've fed the ingredient raw to fish to see the reactions, and trying to build baits around that. Yeah, and then you look at the protein contents, things like that. We've sent stuff off for analysis now. But the major thing is they actually want to eat it. It's like a flavour. You might sniff a flavour. You might love it, but you can't get a bloody bite on it. Mm. No point ever in putting it in a bait. You've got a 15mm little round ball, and there ain't room for anything they don't want to eat.
Yeah.
So, that to me is the start. It's and you get preferences as well. Different lakes, different environments on lakes. It can all make a difference. I made baits first. People who's fishing on rivers make dips, specialised dips for fishing on rivers, and they've caught more fish. Same with lakes, you make a bait work. My lake's an old established estate lake, and it's really silty and everything. I'll make a bait for it. It's not a problem, because I know that different lakes do want different things, but you also get different fish. You get some fish that just never get caught on a certain boilie. And somebody will come in with a cheap ready made or something like that and have that fish quick. You see that, don't you? You get some anglers go onto lakes and catch fish quick.
Yeah.
And I think they, don't know, whether they've done the research a little bit. I know I do try and do a little research bit. I always seem to have to catch everything before I catch a big one. But, it's just how it is. I do like getting bites, but I like to be fishing for the fish I'm after.
Do you think fish have habits with things like types of flavours, like sweet or savoury or colours, or do you think individual fish definitely, have you come across a fish that only eats red boilies or?
Yeah, I've come across fish that were seriously addicted to Robin Red. And that colour, that deep dark red fish meal with Robin Red colour, and it's a very, very good colour. That is, when we messed about years ago with purple, the mate was fishing the little grange, and there's one fish he caught several times, and it's not a usual fish to get caught, once a year fish, and he had it two or three times. Just messing around, we didn't even have a bait. It was purple colouring whatever he was making at the time. And he caught that fish, and we just believed that the purple was the best flavour we've ever found for ages.
Really?
Yeah, it just seemed to be brilliant.
What's the attraction to yellow, do you think? Lots of people use these yellow pop-ups, higher tracks.
I think it really helps that most people with four rods got four of them on.
Yeah.
we had I had this years ago with different people and myself. I like orange.
Yeah.
And if everybody's catching one yellow, I bet you'll catch more on orange. And Geezer was catching nothing at the Manor years ago. I got him some, made him use orange, and he started catching. You know, you can get stuck on one thing. You know, that's why I like the rainbows, what we do, where you got a choice. You know, people going on to pink now, aren't they? Like, you know, first of all, it was yellow, then white was the new yellow, and now pink is the new yellow. And, you know, I know waters where they don't particularly like bright baits no more, and so you're better off not having a bright bait.
Do you think that's angling pressure that's done that to them?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. They learn. You know, everybody's late starts to get harder. You know, and, you know, really when we think about it, like, you expect them to learn. Mm. You know, years ago, I can remember putting pace around a hook. You know, if I'd have had the Herwig then, I'd have caught 10 times more fish. Yeah. You know it. And as soon as everybody got the Herwig, it's a big boost. Then everybody went on to chug rigs, big boost in captures, weren't they?
Mm.
You know, everybody's now waiting for the next new Herwig or the next new chug
rig. Why do you think green's never taken off? It's kind of a colour that you'd, if you were to say what would be the best colour, it's natural, the weed, you know, but it's just never took off, has it?
No.
Kiwi is quite green, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a deep dark green, that's a really good colour that is. I use green quite fluorescent pop-ups quite a bit. What they are, they're sort of like brilliant, you don't get the tufties eating.
Yeah.
You only get the tufties eating at night. As soon as it gets light, you don't get no more tufty pickups. It's brilliant. So you've got a bait out there fishing. I've caught carp on them. Don't use them loads. They're not, I don't know, even I don't like them. But like, you know, if you've got a terrific bird problem, they'll solve it.
Yeah.
You know, what I normally do if I've got a terrific bird problem, instead of putting a pop up on the chod rig, I put a piece of foam on the chod rig. Because there's only carp or stupid enough to eat foam, really. It's like the birds don't eat it. They say you put your flavour on your foam and you're fishing all day long and you're not getting bird trouble. And yeah, I wish I'd remembered that. I've done that donkeys years ago. I wish I'd been doing it when I was fishing fen, because like I've had times when I've just caught tufty duck, and it's just horrendous, and you have to pack up, you cannot get round it. But if I'd, you know, if I'd put foam on, I'd have still been fishing, whether or not as effective as your body. But like, yeah, you know, I've caught a lot of fish on foam chods, and you know, everybody catches a lot of fish on zigs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and with zigs are high up in the water, so you've got the line and things like that for them to be scared of. But on a little sort of like chod or a little, mm-hmm, you know, a short rig on a shallow water, because you don't seem to get that, and you catch fish, and it's.
I remember those round foam boilies that Nash used to do years ago. Yeah. They were rock hard, weren't they? Yeah. They were really good for soaking in flavouring.
Yeah.
I think I used them on frying in because it was full of crayfish at the time. Have you come across crayfish much, any lakes you fished?
Divina was full of crayfish, wasn't it?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I fished in European waters, lots full of crayfish. And like,
is there a solution? Is there a flavour they don't like?
I haven't found a flavour they don't like, and probably the flavour what the crayfish don't like won't, more often than not be a very good carp flavour.
Yeah.
But no, like people say with our new cray boilies that crayfish aren't eating it. I've not actually looked myself because I've been on the water with crayfish in recently. But like, you know, I would be looking to see what happens with the crayfish with that. I just like, you know, skin the boilies or do whatever you'd have to do. You know, eels are another problem on some waters with the boilies.
Yeah.
You know, just things you've got to get around. You know, if I have to, I will put a target on. You've got to have an hook bait on. You know, but like, my nephew, he's caught lots of carp just fishing a single target up and amongst the better boilies. And that's wood problems, that is, not crayfish. There's always a way around. You're not going to sit there not fishing with a bait on here, not unless you're really silly.
I haven't found a low stock big fish water that tiger nuts don't work on yet. I mean, it's
no.
If I was told I could use one bait for the rest of my life, would yours be a boilie?
I'd be scared of pet squid or something like that for definite, because I like to be putting something back into it. I've seen waters with a lot of scared pet squid go in it, and the fish have done well, and you know. Like a tiger nut, there's we've had them analysed. The nutrition of tiger nuts, nothing.
Mm.
You know, it's rubbish. It's complete rubbish. It's like, I said, no, I don't like to fish like that. But yeah, I use them if I have to. But I don't use them as a specific bait, and don't take a big bucket of tiger nuts with me ever. Mm. You know, it's only hook baits usually.
Just something to get a bite. Yeah, something else isn't working, or you need a hard bait or something.
Yeah, I fished a water at Peepa where the eels were a nightmare, and like the carp actually really liked the tiger nuts in there. even the last time I was at Fen Drayton, there was about 5 targets in the margins floated in the edge and they'd all gone rotten, so they didn't get it. But then there was the number of fish in there, they might have not been put where the fish were.
Yeah.
So, and I found them in my data, Syndicate Lake as well. You know, nobody has claimed using tiger nuts. We can use whatever bait they want. I wouldn't ban a bait anyway. But, like, you find floating tiger nuts in there, so...
I didn't know tiger nuts floated up.
Yeah. Oh, when you put one of them, they really stink.
Did
it? Yeah, you wouldn't be eating one of them.
what was it about the Scopex squid that was so good? And I remember you telling me years ago that you had it that sent away to be analysed.
Yeah,
because there was something... You wanted to know why it was so good.
Yeah, and, like, you know... I've just actually obtained the complete recipe for the squid powder.
Yeah.
And that we will be making it ourselves, so the exact how it was, always was. The company what made it, they moved on, and that I bought the recipe off them.
And you think it's the squid that was the...
It's the squid powder, yeah. The squid powder. You put it in almost anything. You put it in monster pursuit, and you know, you can catch more fish. You put it in almost anything. You know, the squid powder itself, the base mix, you know, I had that analysed. Like I was aiming for X nutrition. We worked it out as best we could what freshwater carp would want, cold water carp. Also building in other anglers' baits and natural food. And we just tried to make the best food what we could make. And that's what we did with the squid. And it's been going for sort of like 20 odd years now.
I've never known a bait that doesn't blow. Like, if that squid works on a lake, it works forever on that lake. You know, you look at the lady in St. Ives, and how many times did that fish get caught?
Five, six times. Got caught on it several times. You know, so the amount of fish do, the fish in my lake still eat 4G squid. You know, it's still one of the better baits to use. No, it won't, because it's... Although it seems simple to make, when you look at recipe, it's quite intricate. Like the liver oil, what goes into it is a, you know, got a massive list of elements what go into that to make the liver oil. Same with the Scopex, and you know, even the sweetener isn't just a straight saccharin or just a straight whatever. It's, you know,
is it a couple of types of sweetener. I remember you used to use, was it the Pro Taste and the other one? There was, I remember you telling me one day that like you had to get the ratio right between the two for it.
Yeah, it's usually 50-50, but like. Some things like the tangerine oil, forget the potash, just use the intense sweetener, it's better. Technically it shouldn't be because it's an oil, but it is because it's a very fine oil. Like if you used to sweeten liver oil up, for instance, you know, you'd really want the more potash and less sweetener.
What's the difference between this is trial and error.
Not loads. It's this. Don't tell anybody in Europe, but there's sodium saccharin and sodium cyclamate in them both. But it's how we dissolve them, and it's getting the solubility rate, so they don't come back into solids again. So they actually then go into water better. It's how we get them to actually move through the water column and into the water. You know, all these things, like if you just left them on the table like a puddle of it, it would dry out and just go like salt would. Yeah, whereas we can stop them doing that to a massive degree, and they're only ever going to water. So that's sort of like the difference. So when you're born in it and things like that, you're not denaturing it all, and you know, the sweetener what you're putting is still the sweetener what's going to be there.
How much do you compensate with the boiling? Isn't boiling like counteractive to everything you do in the first place?
It is like you lose a certain amount of nutrition, you lose a certain amount of amino acids. You have to count at that by, you know, like we use a lot of additives, and little trace elements, whatever. So a lot of the ingredients have already got enough in. Part of the squid boil is, you know, that's got a lot of counteractive products in it. So you know, you make a squid boilie and you might have lost something, but you've already countered that. So one of the reasons it's always been so good, because you hadn't lost a lot into it from the cooking and the processing. So
do you think there's something new out there, like the cultured hook baits that are you know, the kind of pace round the boiling thing. I mean, I love those in the water. You only got to miscast and reel it back in straight away. It's going gooey and sticky. And do you think there's the perfect delivery method?
That is it, really, for amino acids and vitamins. You're not denatured them whatsoever. And, you know, the body itself, what's inside, you know, people catch a light on that as well. Like, you know, people say, oh, I had a take after 36 hours. We've got a lot of roach and things like that in your swim. You ain't got a lot of
nothing left
culture around it. You've caught on the body itself. And we've overcompensated with the body itself with more aminos, more vitamins, more, you know, super attractive things, higher levels of flavours in it and everything. You know, it's a special hook bait with a special paste around it, sort of thing.
But why are they called culture? Did they hear they were, it's like actually grown or something?
Yeah, it takes a while to get it on. It's like you sort of like grow it. You like, you start off with a tiny little skin, and after a while you can get it a bit bigger, and it's just a lot of messing about, really.
Yeah,
we've had so many rejects. It's all down to the atmosphere as well, and we've got a controlled room, controlled situation there to make it in. It's like bloody nightmare, to be honest.
That's why they're so expensive.
Yeah, all I want to do is make bait, not be a heating electrician and a plumber and everything else. I just don't, it's not my, really what I want to do. And the trouble is that a lot of our gear is so specialised, you get a plumber in and he thinks you can get by what you want off the shelf. You've got to make it, mate. Yeah. You've got to adapt it. And like, they haven't been trained for that, have they, most plumbers? They just put the central heating in, don't they? That's it. It's that, like,
works in a same
with electricians, and so, you know, it's quite amazing really what you have to do. You know, these new boiler machines, that I've adapted them a little bit and I've made one of them quicker, they're much more accurate. We can put any boiler paste through them, what we ever want to, just like I did on the machines what I originally made years ago. And now I can go back to being Nash bait again. We can make what we want, not what the machine says.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it took a little while because I'm not an engineer. Mm. You know, I'll make something with an angle grinder and things like that. But, like, you know, I've had to do all that. You know.
There's so many things that go into it people don't realise, don't they? I remember you saying that, like, the pop-up mix wasn't going through the 15mm rollers.
That's it.
Perfect. Yeah. And then you have to get something remade to make that bike.
We're just tweaking the pop-up mix again now because we've got better mixing systems and things like that. We make all our pop-ups ourselves. Like, a lot of companies send them out and they're hand-rolled and they're perfectly round and, like, yeah, brilliant, but, like, we need tons and tons of them, you know. And, like, so we actually want to make them ourselves and we want to know what goes into them, like, to our strict recipes, and so, yeah, we were altering the pop-up mix a little bit more now because I want to just take down some of the swelling. Our pop-up swell a bit more, don't it? But that's because the water's going in and there's nutrition coming out, because, like, you know, it's actually makes them attractive. It's just an inert piece of, I mean, crap on the end of your hook. You know, you need to rely on them dips and them flavours, whatever, what you're trying to soak into them. So, yeah, our pop-ups are sort of like, you can take in water on purpose, but people don't particularly like it. So I'm getting the same sort of effect, but without the swelling. And I'm actually tweaking it, because we need a lot of pop-ups to make it at the minute. I'm tweaking it mix by mix. So, you know, like, you've got to be a bit careful, because it's like £1,600 just for the powders, to the mix is what we do. So just tweaking it steadily, mix by mix. And yeah, I'm getting there. Like, you know, we're going to improve our pop-ups massively, the roundness, the fish catching ability and everything.
Do you have a constant balance between what you know is good for the fish and what the anglers actually like the look of?
It irritates the hell out of me when somebody says, oh, your boilies aren't very round. I actually, for myself, hardly ever use a round boilie.
I can't remember the last time I've fed a round boilie. I try not to use them on the hook unless I have to. That's why I love the cultures, because they're all different shapes, aren't they? And I remember you, the very first time I came with Dash Bait 15 years ago or something, you gave me a Scopex squid had just come out, I had a mega session on it, and you sent me these little white hand rolled pop-ups that you'd made yourself, I think. They were like toppers, you know, to go on the make snowmans, and not one of them was round, you know. Everyone was a different size, which is good for balancing the, you know, different.
When I'm hand rolling my own bait, I'll probably do five at a time. When you're hand rolling bait at a show, you want it to be fairly round, I only do three at a time by hand. Yeah, and obviously use baby rolling tables as well, but, like, you know, I won't waste a little bit of a pop-up mix. So the last little bit that comes out of the nozzle has to be hand-rolled into...
What's the biggest, you know, the bit that you get at the end? You always get one sort of lump at the end quite often, makes boilies, so what's the biggest you've caught on?
What's the biggest...
chunk, like, blob.
I've caught on 70mm boilies, and on purpose.
Yeah, and what,
baited, pre-baited with them.
Or
in the manor.
Wow.
Yeah,
70mm boilie at the manor.
Yeah, the massive. You've got a 20mm boilie, yeah? You take three pieces of dough, what makes a 20mm boilie, put that round the 20mm boilie, you've got a 30mm boilie.
Yeah.
So it's like big lumps of dough.
That's a lot of it, yeah, isn't it?
And like, what I do is I roll them around 20mm boilies. If you make a big bulk bait, always roll it around the 20mm boilie, because to cook it through to the centre, if you just start from paste, you destroy the outside and you ain't got a very good bait.
We did it years ago on Sail Marina after reading Lutchison's book, doing the thread, I think it was called, capturing there, he was using big bait. We used them sort of outside because Sail Marina was full of singles at the time, but I've never used to.
Mate, you can get a Mars with a slingshot. I've slingshot them out miles and then can't bloody cast them. I've just put a load. It's like, you know, you can, they are brilliant. They are absolutely brilliant. Yeah. And like, how I baited there, I fished in my singles mostly, and my pre-baiting was fully pockets up, walk around the lake and sort of like one out, one short, one long. Like, there's a swans chasing him off and things like that, and like, it just spread them all around the lake, and then you just fish, you just do a little hit about sort of like 500 of them, 400 or 500 of them, and then the next quite a few days you'd only fish singles where you could find the fish, and you'd get bites like quite easily. I know one of the lads, he did similar on Sutton, and like using great big boilies and like feeding great big boilies, and he caught quite a lot of fish.
Yeah. Do you think it's just because it's different, or
everybody goes the other way, don't they?
Everyone's 15mm, and when it gets hard, they go smaller, don't they?
In the spring, everybody's fishing 15mm in the spring, and then the spawn, and then you want double 20 or triple 20mm hook baits, you'll catch more fish.
Mm.
After they spawned, for some reason or other, they say big bait, they'll eat it quick.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's like, That's just how it is. Like, I got my dating like double 20mm boilies. Everybody's got 10s and 15s on, just because I know the spawn, and I get five that night, and everybody else catches one between them if they're lucky.
Yeah.
You know, I've had, you know, good anglers either side of me, like, took them fishing, like, they've come fishing with me, and like, they blanked, and I've got five. And it's like, you know, people just don't, and they don't listen. It's like, and then they buy another bag of 15mm. It's like, you think,
crazy. You've always done things like slightly different. I mean, I remember seeing your 2 foot hook links on Fendrayton sort of years ago. I mean, how many people have actually cast a 2 foot hook link out as a bottom bait, not a zig? It's,
and long hair usually as well. It's like,
how long's long for hair?
I've used them up to about 2 inches.
Yeah.
Yeah, from when you hold them up, from the bottom of the hook to the top of the bait. Inch and a half is quite sort of like standard.
Yeah. What's the mechanics? You think it's better for bigger just, fish? Or?
Yeah, like when you look at the size of a carp's gob, like it's nearly as big as my cup, isn't it?
Mm.
Like, they're just, you know, how are they going to manoeuvre a pissy little ervig and things like that and get upset about it? They're just going to eat the lot, aren't they?
Mm.
You know, and like, you take that ervig and that bait away from the hook, the hook's got more chance of pricking. That's just how I see it. Like, you know, I use the KD rig a lot. It just like, the hook just drops, doesn't it? It just drops about. It's going to get somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and yeah, I use like the rigs with the like ring on the back of the hook and things like that. I don't use them as well. It depends. If you're fishing in weed, the long rigs don't really work because your hook gets caught on the weed and things like that too much. But then what I often do is a really long knotless knot.
Yeah.
And sometimes go on to even longer shank hook. So the knotless knot is like past the point of the bar, opposite the point. Yeah, and it just lifts the hook up.
Put it all the way around. You tie it all the way around.
Not all the way around, to level with the point.
Ah, right, yeah.
Or the shank, level with the point, and just pass the point.
Yeah.
You know, 22 to 24 turns.
Mm.
You know, and then sort of like six back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks and, like then, and then a longish.
Yeah, I was fishing a charity thing at Frimley.
Yeah.
On the little back lake. Oh, I was a bit peed off that they put me on the little back lake, but there you go. And you know, I lost the fish almost straight away on one of your little rigs with your little ring on and things like that. Screaming take, never felt a thing. Well, caught, like, I wasn't actually at me rods, so it was a proper take. So it won a tench, like a tench would have buried by then.
Mm.
And I like, got the hook link back and everything, just got off, you know. About an hour later, I got a similar sort of take, and I was actually at me, wasn't I? I hit it really quick, and there's nothing there. And other people have said that, so I just went on very long hook links, very long shank hook, with a really long knotless knot, boarded just about half an inch past the hook, and I had three bites and caught three fish and a duck. Yeah, seriously, if I catch a duck, I think I'm really doing well. Because how many times do you catch a duck on Erwick?
Yeah, when
yeah,
compared
that's
a,
that's,
to the ratio.
That's going
to
nail the next carp, isn't it?
Yeah, for, yeah. For, I mean, for the ratio, you get picked up by ducks. You don't want
yeah.
many.
Mallards and tufted, you should catch them because they're putting the body in the mouth.
Yeah,
yeah. You should catch them. That's why, because they've got a different mouth. A coot's got a pointed beak. You don't catch them very often unless you side up.
We've spoke on this show before. A couple of guys, you know, single hook bait type guys, Frank Warwick and forget the other one. But talking about what is the perfect single hook? If you knew you were gonna, you couldn't feed any bait for whatever reason, too far out or whatever. Like, what do you think's key in a single hook bait?
Now, personally, I'd use the cultures.
Yeah,
and I've caught just as many on single bottom baits as what I've caught on a pop up.
Mm.
You know, what is the difference that it's 2 inches off the bottom when you don't, you know, you're casting blind, you almost don't know where the carp is. You're like, you're fishing a single hook bait, 2 inches off the bottom ain't going to make a single difference except if your rig looks better.
Yeah,
you know, and they'll come across a boilie, a free offering, yeah, it's never going to be a pop up, is it? Mm. So they're used to eating them fairly safe.
Yeah.
So I've just done better on bottom baits.
Yeah,
I use bottom baits a lot, to be honest.
What about balance baits you use?
If we use a balance bait, I usually just use a pop up and put a shot on my air rig.
Yeah,
because I usually only have pop ups with me.
Yeah.
I like critically balanced baits, like a snowman type rig.
Mm.
And I do use them quite a lot, and I try and get them so they only just sink. But I do the same with the pop-ups with a shot on the air rig.
And what about flavourings? If you knew you were fishing somewhere single up baits, would you up the flavourings?
I've got little pots of, with me, just like everybody else has with baits, what's been in glug and dips and neat flavour and neat sweetener, just sweetener on its own. I've got them with me, and I'm convinced sometimes you take that one out and it's only been soaked in sweetener, and you chuck it out and get a bite. It worked, do you know what I mean? But it's not going to work every time you go. And like, you know, you quickly get all four rods on it, don't you?
Yeah.
Hoping for the second bite. And it has got me a second bite at times. You know, and then you think it goes a bit quiet, or are you on the fish still or whatever? You know, so then you might have two rods on, you know, a different flavoured one, and if you get a bite on one of them, you're going to have all four rods on them, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, I do a lot of, like, if I get a bite on something, I'll get all four rods on it quick.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if we get a bite on the right-hand rod, my left-hand rod is going to go over to the right of my right-hand rod. You know,
you do whereas, that a lot, right? Yeah. Like,
some people just, if they get a bite, if they see a fish on the right-hand rod, they move the right-hand rod a bit further over, don't they? Mm-hmm. I just never see the point of that. Move the left-hand rod.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just try and remember to swap your bobbins around. If you've got them on. No, that's from piking thing as well. That's like just from fishing other species as well.
You do a lot of other species as well, don't you?
Yeah.
Seem to know about
all you fish. You fish for bites with the other species, then you tend to, if you're not careful, sit and wait for a carp, don't you?
Mm.
And like, you look at my fish in my pond, or even in my stock pond, you put some food and come and eat it. You know, and we're sat there saying the fish aren't feeding. Fish grow, fish do eat pretty much all the time. It's just that we're not doing it right all the time, and it's impossible to do it right all the time. If they're eating fly ash floating up from the bottom at 6 foot and like they're in 18 foot, how do you know that? You got to, you know, you're going to take a while to work it out, isn't it? And you know, I don't know if anybody's ever sort of like, usually just pull zig slowly, letting line out, keep moving into the bait. I would have thought they would have done, and if they hadn't done, they're idiots, like, because it's got to happen and it's got to make a difference. Because when you're fishing even a boilie, you twitch it sometimes, you get a bite quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, most people just pick the rod up and reel in, don't they? Yeah, if you're going to pack up, just move all four rods about a foot, and then just like pack the start, carry on packing your bivvy up and back up. Yeah, I've had bites doing that, and you get bites doing that when you're maggot fishing a lot.
I've done that as a kid, you know, I haven't done that in 25 years.
Well, if you're fishing in weed and crap, like, we can't do it, can you? But like, they are, you know, they are attracted to something moving. They always are.
I've had it where I've had the ducks picking me up and within a second of the duck, I've seen the duck go, I've seen six of them on me, they're hammering it, getting bleep, 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 and then I get picked up, one hits the surface, and you know the duck's just picked you up, and then it goes again, and it's a carp, and you're picking it up, thinking it's another duck, you've hooked it, because you've seen that one. Happened on Clifton, and that time I had about six fish, and on the pump side, I was getting leathered by the ducks, and twice it happened where within 3 seconds of the duck picking it up and dropping it, a carp had had it. And I think the duck had created the competition, he'd grabbed it and the carp's gone, oh, you're not having it, I want it.
When you're fishing in shallow water, not too far, you see that happening.
Really?
I've had the family of coots start picking my bait up, and the next thing, they're sort of like backing off, and there's carp all around them and everything, and you get carp date. Hmm. And yet, until the family of coots come there, the carp just laid sunning themselves.
Obviously, having a knowledge of how everything else works helps to catching carp. I know you used to use the bream on Fen Drayton, didn't you? Used to feed for the bream and then stop feeding.
Bang a load of bait in, let the bream come in, have a nice morning's bream fishing, don't put any more free offerings out, and when their line bites stop and the last bream has definitely gone, quickly put the smaller hook baits on, because I used to fish for the bream with really big hook baits, because you get more bites. Yeah, because how many carp handlers said it didn't matter how big a boilie I put on, I caught another bream. Well, go smaller, mate. Go smaller. We've got them feeding now. I've been looking for the big food items. And, you do that, it's just put a smaller hook bait on, 10 minutes later, you've got a carp.
Mm.
I bit one off the rest before the buzzer's gone before at Fen Drayton.
Yeah.
Line's tight and you have it.
I've got a question on bait there. Back in the day when we first started fishing, the bait seemed to go through that period of first of all it was the oils, and then it was the essential oils, and then there was a phase where the BCSG members were all talking about amino acids and stuff Do you think there's any sort of merit in that? Is there an amino acid combination or an oil combination that a fish will just not be able to resist? It will have to eat
until it gets caught. Until it gets caught, a couple of things. Anything what's really really noticeable, and they come and eat. The really really noticeable next time, they make their minds up not to eat it, don't they? And
it's dangerous.
I've said that on at the minute, there's a lot of people struggling on the glugged pop-ups and the high flavoured, high tracks hook baits and things like that. If they just take a bag, get the bag of bodies, just take one out of that bag and put that out, I'm sure they'll catch more. I've always got a lot of fish
that have been hammered on it.
My dating it late, they're hammered it on the zigs, and now it's hard to catch them on the zigs, and they're all blaming the blue dye, they're blaming this, blaming that. Carp aren't that bloody stupid.
Mm.
They do learn, and next spring there'll be a few caught on the zigs and they go out again. And the only people who's catching on the zigs leave them out at night. But regularly recasting to keep that line thin, because you get all that build up around your line, don't you? And they're just the ones that think about it catching them.
The main reason I asked that question is the story James, I've told you a few times, when I went fishing once with two older carp anglers, took me fishing as a lad, and I made up some semolina, soya flour, sodium carcinate boilies with maple cream flavour, sweetener, and they were yellow. I made them one day, and by the time I was going to use them the next day and go fishing, I left them out in the sun and they'd gone off. They smelled, in them days, your hand on, there's only 300 in a maggot tub. They'd gone off, and to smell, they were vinegary, and you could see little white dots on them. So I thought, oh shit, I'm going to have to use them. So I went fishing the next day with these two anglers that were experienced and fished this water for years. I was in the middle of them, they never caught nothing, and I had 20 fish. The fish were obviously, for whatever reason,
there was something they liked,
not interested in their bait, for a metal. Mine was giving a signal off, my bobbins were just, I just couldn't stop.
I've made up bait mixes before where you sort of stop measuring things, you think, I'll just put a bit of that in, I'm supposed to be testing that, and you put a bit of that in, you get loads of fish on it, and you wish you'd wrote it down.
What do you think happened with that vinegary smell?
There'll be the amino acids and things breaking it down, and it's like goes to another stage, doesn't it? When something starts to be digested, it's going to another stage, because I'm pre-digested fish meals, and stuff like that. You say about the said sodium castanate, yeah.
You get
the mold what gets the little white dots.
Yeah.
And that's really good. With calcium castanate and caseins, you get a mold that goes into like a slime. That definitely seems to be a fish repellent.
Mm.
You know, and it's like on some fish meals, like, you know, the Purina 66 is the best example. Your bodies go sort of like white all over, don't they? That's definitely an attractant. So you're just getting like further development, and it's a little bit how the cultures work. Like, you know, they're working, once they get in the water, then amino acids and everything start breaking down, and like breaking down some of the other ingredients, what's actually they're bind to the body with. And so, you know, they change slightly as, and it carries on for hopefully 12-14 hours, you know, just changing it. It's like different, like, you know, it's not something what you could put in a bag and put in every body and do it. It is different, you know, and your bodies would have been seriously different because they're already starting to break down. And it's hard to emulate it every time.
To this day, that is the most productive period, and it was, the fish just couldn't resist it.
No,
only by chance, it's by complete fluke. I've never been able to do it since.
See, I used to use a lot of, you know, before I really making bodies, I used a lot of paste, and before I did that I used a lot of tinned luncheon meat and stuff like that, and you know, bacon grill was definitely better than luncheon meat. 100%. And I've caught lots of fish. I caught a brace of 20s out of Lakeside Lido donkey years ago, when, you know, most people didn't catch a 20 pounder in Lincolnshire, and like, you know, it was just definitely better. And because I liked it, I cooled it up as small as possible, and it's all about surface mass then. You're giving out more, aren't you? You know, it's like if you had a big piece and drowned it with bacon grill flavour, it would be the same as 20 little pieces. And so I was giving them to 20 little pieces, and getting them to where I wanted to be, it was like mental, like really difficult, like, you know, all the different silly ways what he invented then, which now you could just put them in a PVA bag or put them in a spawn, but like, you had to get them out there. So I was like sticking them together, leaving them in the sun, bit of flour, making little balls. You chuck them in, but first of all you chuck a few in the edge and make sure that they break down nice. You know, didn't just sit there inert, and, you know, and that's what I did. It's like, you know, just doing that. And you weren't allowed to night fish, so you go to the pub, and on the way back you put a bit of bait in. Always works, doesn't it? A bit of pre-baiting, you know, and then you're straight on them.
You think, it sounds really obvious, but pre-baiting, I've never done a pre-baiting campaign, it's not paid off. Is it just as simple as getting them feeding with no lines in the water? I think it's
absolutely nice. And it's just building the confidence up, and it's like, you know, it just turns them into feeding, and if it's what you're putting in, they're going to be eating what you're putting in. I was away for Christmas for about 4 days. I come home with my fish pond, the fish was all just laid on the bottom, and it took me 2 days to get them eating again, proper eating, like where you walk up to the pond and half of them at least come straight to you.
Yeah,
you know, it took me 2 days.
Is that so? Do you think in winter, like when people say you've got to keep people fishing, got to keep the bait going, and you think that is a thing, you've got to keep them in the habit?
I seriously think it's critical.
Yeah.
You know, this year I never fed my Datic Lake early in the autumn, sort of thing, like I normally do. There's always a spell where, you know, you're there on a Sunday night and there's nobody there. I've always got food down there, so you just quickly go out the boat and give it some. I never did that at all this year, and it's fished its worst ever. But there's probably other reasons.
It's been a bad year, isn't it? It's been a bad winter, like, isn't it?
My Datic Lake, you know, people last year, it was like somebody had 17 fish in a day.
Mm.
You know, all pretty much all 25 plus. It's not an hard lake in the winter with a decent angle behind a set of odds. It's, but like, just everybody is struggling.
So you think once they shut down, if, you know, say there's no one fishing for a few weeks and the water goes cold, they shut down, and that's it.
At least a concerted effort to get them going again. Yeah, a little bit like my fish pond. Obviously, there's a lot of fish in a small amount of water, and I can see them. I know exactly where to put the food when they won't come to me. I've give the food to them. Like, there's all underneath the waterfall, so I just dropped on the waterfall, let it fall down the waterfall, and that's what started getting them moving.
So it's just
getting in the lake. You can't see where they are. You're not sure really where they are. I fished my syndicate lake a little bit last March, totally blind, ain't got a clue where there was. You know, I just moved about a bit, that's all I could think of doing. And like, you know, I was working down there as well, but I never got a bite. You know, I caught a pike in the end. It was like so exciting. I nearly had a freaking heart attack, but like, yeah, proper take, it's a pike. I didn't even fought like a carp with this bloody thing.
A boilie off the bottom, is it?
Yeah. And yeah, I didn't know where there was, but I'm sure if I'd have found him, if I'd known where there was, the year before, I think it was, or probably the year before that, somebody went over there with an echo sound and they found him and had 3 bites the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like, it's, you've got to be on them. They won't move to the bait and things like that. In the summer, you bait an area up, and more and more carp will start coming to it until you start fishing it and putting them under pressure. And like on a river, if you don't pre-bait, you're almost wasting your time. Yeah, it's a massive thing on a river to pre-bait. But like, yeah, pre-baiting definitely will catch you more fish.
What about liquids as an attractant? Mark Holmes came on this show 6 months ago, 12 months ago, and he reckoned he got really into liquids. He was finding delivery devices, you know, to leave liquid in the water as a replacement for bait, sort of thing.
Yeah.
You've seen fish get really turned on by attractors?
I have, definitely. Where you can see them, like in my fish pond, in my stock pond, things like that, I pull to attractors right in the very edge and see fish start to come to them straight away. Mm. It's, you know, and that's why we put them in the bait. That's why we put them in the body. It's how I'm attracted to fish. People say about using bodies with no flavours in. I've never seen a one with no flavours work better than one with flavours in, with the liquid flavours. And some liquids, like some of the essential oils, like black pepper oil, I've always found it works much better if you've also got a lot of, say, any decent fish extract with it.
Mm.
And yet the fish extract definitely benefits from the black pepper oil. So yeah, I think you've got to have a volume of water solubles at least products. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can do it another way. I've done it with bodies with hardly any flavour in, and I've done it with bodies made with sort of like flavoured dog biscuit and stuff like that. You know, just pre-soak it a little bit, let the water already get working. And a lot of the time, we sell food dips and all sorts of different dips. When I use them, I actually usually 50-50 them with water before I put them on my bait anyway.
Right.
And it didn't stem from them tightening them, Lincolnshire, or anything like that. I just feel it's already started and working.
Mm.
You know, if something has to sit in the water and takes 20 minutes or 30 minutes to start working, if you're on fish, like you're fine fishing in the evening, you ought to catch them in the evening.
Mm.
You shouldn't be satisfied if you catch them in the morning. After 12 hours, you should have had them when you found them.
Yeah.
And like, you know, if you've already started your bait working before it actually hits the water, you've got to have given yourself an advantage. You see it with roaching and bream and things like that, where you do get more bites. You know, you sort of like already get it working, it's better. And I use pre-soaked bodies a lot when I'm fishing the water regular. You know, I actually use air-dry bags, but I always put them in the water. I've never hung one in a tree yet.
Pre-soaked in lake water.
Yeah, yeah. And like, when you, like, you have plenty done, and when you pack up and go home, you take that bucket, that bag out, and you put it in a bucket, you take it home and you put it in the freezer, and it's ready for your next session. You've got to remember to take it out of your freezer, that takes ages to thaw out. But like, you know, I've done that a lot. I used it down the manor with a key. Like the last year I was in the manor, I caught a fish every morning, caught a fish, went home straight away because I just found it boring. But like, you know, and it works. And somewhere like the manor, the wood and everything hammer you absolutely. Anybody who puts bait in, just it gets dark at the manor and northern place like that, might as well have not put the bait in, because the wood will have it all of it. So you're fishing with a single up bait, so yeah, you hope single up baits do catch your fish, because that's all you're fishing with. Yeah, but like, if you, so like what I do with rod and nuisance fishing, whatever, the marsh most active either side, an hour either side of dark.
Mm.
So you just let it get dark, well dark, 3 hours later you put that bait in ready for morning. Mm. And you'll catch carp in the morning. And I've seen it at Northie, I put a bait in and caught I had a bite an hour after putting it in, three nights in the trot. You know, to blue fish cause, you know, spoil the swim on the fight. But like, yeah, each night I put bait in at midnight, I've got to take at 1 o'clock in the morning. But everybody else put a load of bait in just as it's getting dark. The rudd had it. You know, I've got sort of like braid, about 5-6 foot of braid, tied 20 mil body to it. I did it with different bodies as well. Chucked them all in the margins, forgot about them, just while I was sort of like having something to eat as it's getting dark. Remembered about them, pulled them in, and I've got an empty braid on the end of the net. It's gone. So every single free offering, what you've done, it's gone. You're just feeding the rudd. It's like when you feed the birds. People feed the birds, don't they? You see people throwing, sticking, and you just, mate, nothing's getting to the bottom. Yeah. Stop. Wait till just after dark, or an hour, half an hour before it gets dark, because the gulls go to roost, don't they? Just half an hour before it gets dark, so you can get a bait in. Or have a little plastic practice, so as soon as it gets dark, you just do it in the dark with your eyes closed, don't you?
People have habits, don't they? They used to, you know, I put my rods out an hour before dark, and then I spot up for a bit.
In bed, aren't they? In the bivvy and everything. watching YouTube or whatever they do.
I remember you telling me a story about setting up on Fendrayon in the pouring rain and you'd left everything outside and ended up sleeping bag, everything soaked.
Yeah, absolutely skin. Soaked.
It's got a sleeping absolutely. Chest raiders.
Yeah. And it was early in the day, well, it was bloody cold, but like, it wasn't a good drying the day, either the next day, so I just had a miserable session, really. From memory, I don't think I see out, caught out, or anything that suits the trip.
For people that haven't seen you fishing, I don't know, you just look like a homeless man with everything scattered around the swim, I think is the best way to describe it.
They all laugh at me here. I get all my tackle from returns. Right. So if you send something back what's broken, Baze is probably going to be using it. Yeah, that's where all my tackle comes from. I don't see the point of getting something what isn't broken, because I'm only going to break it anyway. But on my bait, yeah, that's a different matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, even though I was buying tackle and bait, I'd buy cheap tackle and deer bait.
Yeah.
That's how I would be.
You think it's the key to everything?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like when you buy a pair of binoculars, you need a good pair, don't you?
Mm.
Yeah, well, so you might as well not buy binoculars. You might just squint more, aren't you? It's like, yeah, it's everything you do, and the bit what matters needs to be sorted.
You gave me one of my favourite quotes, actually, which was about using mozzie nets. You don't like them because it traps them inside and makes them more angry.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. See, with the mozzie, I always used to get, I don't so much now, something I've grown out of, I suppose, but I used to get a bit terrible. Yeah, I used to be set. I can remember I used to be setting up at Fendrayon or anywhere. I used to be out on the boat in the middle of the lake with waterproof trousers, waterproof jacket on, so I didn't get eaten while I was getting my bait set.
Mm.
I was sweating my nuts off. I wasn't like, you know, everybody used to think it was hilarious. And then in the morning, they're covered in big bumps and lumps where they've been eaten alive, and I aren't.
Mm.
You know, it's like, but then as soon as you take them waterproofs off and you've got all your ones out, put some DEET on, and then you don't need a mozzie net.
Mm.
You don't need to get inside your bibby. You know, you don't need to, you can sit on the log or something watching the lake and hopefully move in the morning to fish, or see that you've got your rods in one position and put them out again or whatever.
We've been nearly an hour, it's absolutely flown, but we haven't even talked about any of your own fishing, so I think before we go,
that'd be easy.
Well, you were the first person to catch a 60 pound fish, weren't you, in the UK?
Yeah.
Which was the Collingbrook fish. Tell us a bit about that. What was the story leading up to it? What did you have to work out?
Well,
did you just fluke it out 1 week? What
happened? It's always a fluke, isn't it, when you get a bite. It's like, yeah, unless you really, really know what you're doing, and nobody really knows what you're doing because you can't see underwater, can you, all the time? Float fishing is probably different. And there's the thing with float fishing. How many times you pull the, just tighten your line up a little bit, moved your bait and had a bite?
Yeah.
So why do it on the top and not on the bottom? But yeah, Collingbrook was just, you know, I'd come off the manor, sort of like catching quite a lot of fish, getting a bit bored with it, to be honest, and I just wanted somewhere quieter, and not easier, but like just somewhere quieter and a different challenge. And it was a totally different challenge.
Mm.
You know, they wouldn't eat beds of bait.
No.
You know, just come off the manor where you fill it in, you go to Collingbrook with like, you know, part owned in a bait company, and you just got like van loads of bait available. It didn't work. It's a bit of a bummer. And you found that most people were either caught a fish, it was cast a showing fish, and it's a single up bait, and actually mostly a bottom bait.
Yeah.
Bottom bait's definitely the bottom, a 20 mil bottom bait definitely outfished as a single up bait almost any other presentation there. But it's all in slow motion because there's hardly any fish, so you know, every bite has got to mean something. You've got to digest it, whether it's your bite or not, and like try and engineer your bite, the next, you being the next person to get a bite. And it was just dead interesting. It was like, you know, the year I caught two toe was what, my fourth year. I think I lost it in September. I lost a very big fish in September. Not me once again. And I got it out of a massive weed bed, but it was on for 25 minutes and like it was bloody heavy. And that session, I also lost another fish in the weed beds when I was up with rods. And it's just like massive, it's just a horrendous weedy year. I had that fish on for 20 minutes and it fell off in the end. And to be honest, it made me that angry. You know, it's two fish in the session lost. It made me that angry. I packed up, I got on the phone to the owner, moaned about that we should have a boat there for fish rescue, and might be like getting on stuck in the weed and everything, it's ripping the gobs up and everything. He didn't seem that bothered. he moaned at me. I can't remember exactly, but it's sort of like your ticket's sort of like not ever so safe if you carry on going off. Paul Ford was the only other person there, so I packed up, went round to him, had a moan about it. He didn't seem bothered. It made me that angry. Like, I've seen some smaller fish in another area. Maybe that angry, I got two rods out of the car and caught one on purpose. And I gave it so much stick and I landed it. And like, when I got it in, I cut it up. You know, it's like, it's got a spit dorsal in it. It's like, I felt really bad then. And I even got Paul Ford to photograph it. And I even said that in an article in a magazine. Mm. You know.
So that's like, good job you caught the big enough to.
Well, yeah. So in October, you know, you've got three bites. What you found at Conibo, it's like a lot of these hard, slow waters. Yeah, Fenn was the same a little bit. You'd be weeks, nothing happening. And then in a few days, there'd be five bites, six bites. Yeah. So immediately you need to know what depth they caught that fish at. Mm-hmm. You know, and like in September, every bite, I think there's five bites in September. I had three of them, and there's only 11 foot of water. All of them were. So you need to know your lake a bit, and if somebody's cast up there, you don't ask him if he plumbed it, you just see where his cast was, don't you? Because you've got eyes like watching everybody, and you don't give a damn what rig it is. What I mean, that depth was important. In October, I went back in October and I caught two tone in October, and I caught another fish that night as well. All the bites in October, I think there was five bites in October as well. Think it was like only a few days, like the rest of October was a waste time, just a few days. And I'm pretty certain there was only 9 foot water, which is what I've got two tone from.
Yeah,
you know, it makes a difference at depth on them sort of like fairly deep waters. It always just makes a difference at the manor. You know, you find like suddenly you're getting all the bites at 12 foot, you know, and you'd have that one rod chucked in deep water or shallow water. I mean, nearly all the bites come in 12 foot for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, and then it all
triggers. Just water temperature.
It's just comfort. It's water temperature. It might be, you know,
where the food is
available, or where everybody's chucking the food. Mm. You know, everybody chucks baits in are actually pre-baiting, aren't they? Whether they're fishing on it, catching nothing, going home, they're not taking the bait back with them. Mm. It's, you know, it's all adds up to, you know, food available, which is how we worked out the scope at squid recipe. You know, it's all part of it, isn't it? You know, when you get to a lake, when you get, like, I'm going to Fance this year for the first time, I can't remember ever going to a pay lake before, to be honest. Going to an actual pay lake in Fance this year. Yeah. And, you know, there'll be quite a few people there on the first week it's open, the week before us, they're going to chuck some bait in, aren't they? Mm. So I'm going to take a lot of bait because there's another lake just down the road from it, and we're going to pre-bait that and have a last night or two on that, maybe. But, like, I'm going to start with very little bait because there's going to be a fish on somebody else's bait. And it's quite good. Like, I'm gonna, you know, I would look to see where I think they fished. Might be to put my first two single up baits, you know, because they've already pre baited for me. So, I'm not gonna spoil it all and chuck a load of bait on top of fish what might be eating their bait. It might not work, it might not, you know. But I've caught quite a lot of single up baits while I'm put the rods out and get everything else sorted, you know, and like tart around and get your bibby set up and things like that. Bang, you've got a rod, you've got a take. Yeah.
Just reminded me of one of your pre-baiting tricks to keep people out of the swims. You told me about years ago. You don't actually put a load of bait in the lake, you just pour it all in the edge where people can see it. They think because you're on the bait that you've just put 100 key in.
Isn't it? If you're baiting up fairly heavy, everybody's moaning that we're baiting up heavy, put some in a bucket, leave them in the back of your garage for a week or two until they're all rotten and float up to the top. They put some of them in the edge. And then they stop fishing because Maisie's filling it in and they start rotting and like, they're not. And everybody disappears, you get more swims available. If Tiger Nuts are banned, if somebody's like always in a swim or whatever, he's a bit of a nuisance, whatever, he's just wherever he's been, just get some Tiger Nuts in the swim.
Any more?
There's loads. There's loads and loads and loads.
Well, we better leave it there, I think, before we get some people banned from lakes. But
likewise, if you're doing something, if you are pre-baiting, it is a horrible when somebody, you get there on a Friday night and somebody's already in your swim, what you've been pre-baiting all week. But that's how it is. So just don't pre-bait just one spot.
Yeah.
When I got two tone, I actually waited for somebody to pack up. No. When I got two tone, it's the only swim. It's the only swim. And it's one I've been pre-baiting. How lucky is that?
Yeah.
In September, I had to wait for somebody to pack up because I wanted to get on my bait to swim. And they weren't even casting to the right place or anything. And it didn't really matter where they was casting to because, like, you know, I knew I was like oh, I thought I'd got a really good chance, and there'd been a bite that day, so you know, you knew you was sort of like on that little 3 or 4 day spell.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so yeah, I actually waited, you know, I wasn't just interested in getting the rods out, I wanted to be where I knew I should be. Mm-hmm. And that's different. Like, so people look at a lake and they go, oh, that swim's gone, that swim's gone, oh, that's nearest, or that's the most comfy, or that's whatever. You know, you don't look at a lake thinking where you want to be, you look at a lake thinking where the fish might be, and you know, and that's the way to catch a few more, isn't it? Yeah, I can't wait to fish this year. We talk about my fishing now, but my fishing this year has been almost non-existent. I've been building a bait factory since well before Christmas, doing a lot of the work myself, and like, because you know, you get people in and like they don't sort of like work how I want it to work, and it's come out good. Everything's working really good. You know, there's a few little things I just want to do, and like we're looking at increasing drying space because we've now made the boarding machine quicker, we ain't got enough freaking drying space. So, you know, that's my next little project, making a part-time drying room. You can either use it as a drying room or not, depending on what quantity of bodies we're making at the time. So, you know, I'm air conditioner, plumber at the minute, and tomorrow and the next day will be. And
but once it's settled, you can have some fish.
But like, I'm going to, next week, and I'm netting the reserves at Fendrayton. Let's net the reserves at Fendrayton. Yeah, because we couldn't catch bloody things. So
are you interested to see what's in there?
I'm dead interested to see what's in there. I don't know how successful we'll be. I don't know what the weed beds are going to be like, because if it's weedy, it's hard to electronet. They're just hiding the weed and you just stun them and they don't float to the top.
What are the chances of that big linear turning up, or one of the old
we think we know it is, and that's where we're starting.
Really?
Oh, not the big linear, sorry, no, the client.
Ah, right.
Somebody's
seen the older ones.
Somebody's seen a real big fish in one of the lakes, which is a common, could be that striped one. You just don't know. Or they could be down the river.
We both saw that striped
piece. Yeah, I've seen that. It's massive. It was absolutely massive compared to anything else I've seen at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and like,
I saw it when I was fishing for Heather and Arthur, and you know, the car park, it was clear, you could get up all the big eye trees, you saw them every day, and I was used to looking at scraper 50-pound fish every day of the week, and I saw that stripey from up the tree, and Dave's seen it first, and we both seen it, and I saw it the week after in the same area on the jungle bank, and it was the biggest fish I'd ever seen, and I'd been looking at 50-pound carp daily that season.
Well, when I went on to a Fendrayton, I'd come from Conningbrook, I'd been holding a 60-pounder.
Yeah.
And it was, I'm not saying it was 60-pound, but it was in the same sort of class. It was like,
when we seen it, well, when I seen it from the boat, it was with another fish that was big.
Yeah.
A linear type fish.
Yeah.
Big linear fish. And as the linear moved away, it spooked him eventually. I could see the light, the scales lifting on the side of the linear, but the stripe, but the common was visibly bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. I see quite a good look at, not just glanced or fish jumping, quite a good look at. I've seen stripey, I've seen a real fat one, what was probably the old grey mirror, or must have been the grey mirror's brother or something, because the grey mirror used to be the most stupid carp on the lake, because suddenly we were allowed to fish the lake and you can use boats and it never got caught, so I assume the original grey mirror has gone. But I see one that sort of shape, like head on round, like a steering wheel. You know, it's a really heavy fish, and I think I'm pretty certain I lost that fish, thought like the next time I went, then I baited up, found it, baited up on the, say, a Wednesday, and I went back on the Sunday and I had a take and lost it in weed. And I see a really, really long fish mirror, quite scaly, but I don't know how deep, but I was going along in the boat and it was going alongside me, alongside a bar, like a really windy bar, so it's like trapped between me and the weed for 20-30 seconds. Quite a good look at it. Yeah, you know, like people say, well, I want a very good look. But
the scaly one I see was with the common was longer than the common.
And I saw one on the following week. It was when you were there. We'd gone in with the boat, and since David was up the tree, and he rung us saying, "This is the biggest fish I've ever seen in my life." I thought he'd hurt himself. He was that excited on the phone. He was like almost screaming. We were already out on the boat, weren't we? We went over to look, and there was a big, long, really long, you know, fish with it. I think Shelley said it was one hadn't been seen for years. I forget which one he said. He reckoned there was two of them, but he'd never seen them. They were before his time.
Kissing mirrors, probably.
That's right.
I see that. I see them together a couple of three times, but the one what I saw wasn't either of them two.
No.
And you know, like you see a load of scaly rivers, didn't you? Not big,
yeah, 20s, what, a group of them, yeah.
I never see them at all. Then one day I caught one really scaly river, about £24, put the rod back out. Oh no, the other rod went, because I was fishing two rods in the same spot. The other rod, I caught another one, I thought I'd cut it again.
Yeah,
it's like a scaly mirror. You want to look at the photos that you can see there was definitely different fish, and like, you know, I never seen him before that, I never seen him again, and I never seen him swimming in the lake. And you've seen quite a few, didn't you?
I seen one day, I seen two groups of fish, and one of them, the Bayes's common and the humpyback were in this group,
yeah,
and there was about six of the commons about the same size,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
I'd never heard of, you know,
yeah,
like. And like I say, you don't mistake the humpy when you see
I've seen that in a group of fish, that seven or eight fish, all about the same size except for one small one.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah, what yeah, I saw that but day.
They
never got caught, did
I had
they?
Bases, I had three different 34-pound plus fish, commons, all different, and I'm sure I had four, but everybody says, oh no, it's the other one again, and it don't bloody look like it to me, but like, you know, I don't care how many's in there, I've just got another one, as far as I'm concerned. That's the beauty of commons, you don't get repeat captures very often.
What, if you, all the fish you get out of the reserves, are they all going back into Fenn?
Fenn, Ferry and Swasey, we've got legal permission to do it, legal permission to move these fish, we've done it properly.
We've
got about 50 pieces of paperwork to work to.
Are you going to make it public knowledge what you get out of the reserve?
Maybe. Don't really need to. I've got full syndicates anyway. I run the syndicates now. I've got full syndicates, yeah, anyway.
Have you got Ferry as well now?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well.
And the thing is, everybody, all the anglers are secretive. Like, you don't get no photos. Like, you have to sort of like pin them to a tree and sort of like threaten to gouge your eyes out to find out what they caught the year before.
Yeah.
And if that's how it wants to be, I'm going to leave it like that. As long as I can fill the syndicate, I don't need to advertise it, and I don't need to break that spell of what is Fenn, Drayton, Ferry and Swavesey. So I don't, you know, it's not like Bayswater advertising, got a website, this, that and the other. You know, I don't really, it doesn't, you know, it's more paperwork, and you've got a website, you've got to bloody keep it up to date and things like that. My Bayswater website's about 6 months out of date at the minute. But what would I do? Put photographs of other anglers with the same fish again. It's like looking at the cart mugs, isn't it? You know, you look at the cart mug and you go, who's on the front cover? Not the angler, what fish, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it is nice to see it, and I will catch it up. Well, I won't, actually, I'll start again, but like, that's it now, I just started 2017 and we're back.
I'm like, really interested to see what's in those reserves though.
Oh, seriously, yeah,
you know, for years,
yeah, we've been, the last 2 years we've been legally allowed to fish them at a certain time of year,
yeah,
done that deal with the RSPB, because we are, you know, RSPB, everybody says, like, you know, anglers are against RSPB, the RSPB are probably against angling, but like, if you work together, you know, everybody should be a sensible adult, whether they're a bird watcher or an angler. You work together, you can, and that's what we are doing with them. You know, it's a little bit of a battle here and there, but they're having a little bit of a battle, like, you know, they hate boats on Fenn, Drayton, because I've got a license to use boats on Fenn, Drayton, they're staying. They hate it. And I can understand why. You know, you get the island in there full of little egrets, somebody goes out in a boat and they'll fly off.
Yeah.
You know, little egrets have to find somewhere else to live, mate. It's like, you know, that's how it is. You know, they'll take over from the herons or something. Like, I'd rather have the herons than the scabby foreign birds. And
it's working together, yeah, isn't it?
It is working together. We all get on well. Like the warden there, Tim, he's like a brilliant bloke. He's a really nice bloke. Yeah, we're going to take him fishing.
Yeah, you know, get him the carp.
And yeah, we've been out to fish the reserves, and it's been difficult because like the accesses are really horrible. Everybody wants to do it, they can't wait to do it. And then they realise they've got to go through sort of like 50 metres of brambles. You've got areas where the willow scrub might be so tight together, you cannot get through with more than one item of a fishing tackle. You might have 30 yards, 30, 40 yards of that to get through before you actually get to the water. When you get to the water, you're totally visible, so you're not allowed to fish just there. You've got to fish somewhere where you're not visible. And it's like a nightmare for people. And like, we've cut swims out, my nephew cut swims out, and you get another angler to take it over. So, you know, they're a little bit, the anglers are not really prepared for that sort of fishing. So I don't actually want them to do it again. I want them, because also, like, you know, the RSPB said it's okay, but like, come mid-October, you get up in the morning, you go stand near the edge, and the lake takes off because all the migrants are coming. And I said to him, like, we've got to be off here by mid-October, not end of October, isn't it? It's all right, they aren't settled yet. I don't get that. I think, yeah, I would have come off mid-October. And like, you know, But it's good, it's good. Like, they are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful places.
The Feds have always had an attraction to me. You never know what's in there. It's so nice around there. Yeah. The mystery.
Fed Drayton is... We put a fish in at the reserves, £21, yeah? Bear in mind, this is wild bred fish, yeah? At £21. Don't know how long it's been coming up to £21 out of one of the reserves. Put it in Fen Drayton, it was caught almost to a day, a year later at 28.
Mm.
Yeah, there's something about Fen Drayton and Ferry Lagoon, and probably not so much Fraser, but Fen Drayton and Ferry Lagoon, when you put fish in them, they just grow well.
Yeah.
And yet you can't see fish from the reserves, and you look in the reserves, lots of 20s. Well, unless you age them, like, I'm not really sure how old they are, but some of them might be quite old, but you put them into the bigger lake, or not even the bigger lake, the different lake, and they grow real big again.
Mm.
You know, I took two fish out of my stock pond and put them in my day to get lake, a 26 and a 30 in the winter, just before Christmas. I got caught just after Christmas, both £1.12 up in the winter. It's just because they're put into a bigger water, a bigger environment, and taken out that crowd. Mm. Like, they just go, boom, they just grow.
You think sometimes just the change with fish?
Yeah, as long as it changes for the better.
Yeah.
You get, you know, foreign imported fish, don't you? It's used to do. And then put a 40 or 50 in, and it'd be a 30 in no time, wouldn't it?
Yeah, they shrink.
Yeah, it's a change for the worse, that, isn't it?
It's like put a fish that's stunted in an overstocked lake into another lake. They seem to rocket, don't they?
Yeah, really. They hold back. They grow to the environment, and then given the chance, give them a better, bigger environment, they grow again.
Mm.
You know, Kevin's proven that loads of times with his fish, and he's not even big lakes, he's in lakes are, but they're just controlled. He doesn't have hundreds of fish in it, he has X amount of fish in it, and you know, he works it out and gets it, and he's got the job done, sort of thing, for growing big fish.
Yeah,
and that's a similar thing what I've done to Bayswater. You know, last winter I took 530s and 220s out of my syndicate lake, you know, put them in. But the day to get lake, and some of the anglers like moaned about it, but like, they all want to catch £45 plus fish, but then they all want to bite. Well, like, you know, in the old days, you just put three rods in the cart, day to get lake, and three rods in the syndicate lake, you could get both, but like, it's got too busy to do that now. We've got bloody otter fences everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, my legs aren't big enough to get over the otter fence.
Well, we've been ages and ages, as usually happens when we talk to you. Lots of tangents, but I'd like to thank you for joining us on the Carpcast.
No problem.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So a big thank you to Gary. Love listening to Gary talk. Just before we end, I did say earlier that we were going to speak to Ali Hamidi, and I did manage to get hold of Ali in the lead up to the Northern Angling Show, and let's say hello to him. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Ali Hamidi. It's our once yearly chat. It always seems to be when the big one comes out, and the big fish off comes out, and the NAS show is upcoming. It always seems to come back at the same time. How are we doing?
Boy, you
slip there,
Jamie. Promoting someone else's show.
We are friends with all the shows, you know. We wish them all success, and you know, one day we'll own the world, so it's all good.
There's only one show up north, though, isn't there? Worth a jot, and that's yours. So, looking forward to being there again. Always get a wicked reception as well, and obviously, as I always claim to be an adopted northerner. Red side of the horse cow. Even though, believe it or not, Jamie, you're going to laugh at this, right? Liverpool Everton on the Saturday of the show. Now, 999 times out of 1,000, if I'm in this country, I would be at that game.
Yeah.
But they moved the kick off till 12:30 in the day, so I was hoping they'd move it back. So for my love of the Northern Angling Show, I'm missing the Merseyside Derby to be at the show.
No way.
So, cue the violins.
Oh no!
Chewing, mate. Play some violin sound effects over this now.
I can only assume you couldn't get tickets or something. I mean, I don't believe this.
I've got a season ticket, so I've always got a ticket, mate. Yeah, so it's definitely not that. I'll get a ticket for any sporting event if I want. I want it that bad, but and 12:30, as you know, is normally the busiest time of the shows where you're going to meet the most amount of people, and I don't want potential sort of followers and people who have questions that are coming there, maybe on the off chance that they actually want to come and talk to me, and then missing, me having gone off to the football. It's only one Merseyside derby, so I've been to plenty before, so you can stop the violin music now.
you can just ask them all the score when they come up. Don't worry, it'll be all right. So the show always seems to tie in with the new series of The Big Fish Off. They've given you another one. Is there plans for series four as well now? You're underway of three?
Yeah, we're already signed up for four. Actually, we're signed up for series two and three of Monster Car.
Yeah.
And series four of The Big Fish Off. So things are going quite well on that front. You can never get complacent because you're only as good as your last series, aren't you? So you always got to kick on and get better and stronger. So hopefully, hopefully there'll be a five and a six, or if there isn't a five and a six of that, there'll be a one and a two or something else, you know, on ITV. So that's the plan.
Fantastic. And the show one aired, was it last week, with Ricky Hatton and
Johnny Nelson?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Johnny was probably one of the strongest guests we've ever had on as a character. Brilliant. And, last year the show didn't coincide with the Northern Angling show. We were showing some of the outtakes. It actually went on in April last year, but this year, the very first year it did, it was perfect timing. And this year it has again. So we'll be three episodes in, because we've got this Thursday, we've got next Thursday. I don't know where this will be played out, but in my world, there would have been three shows on air by the time the Northern Angling show lands, and so there'll be a fair bit of banter flying about. There'll be a fair bit of story would have evolved by then as well. So someone somewhere will be getting loads of chip.
Who's on the next two shows then? Have we got?
Oh, we've got an incredible next two shows. The second episode is one of my all-time sporting heroes, and that's Jimmy White, Jimmy the Whirlwind White, versus the King of Bling, Bobby George. So you've got darts and snooker. So, very popular in the Northwest as well, both of those sports, having been up there, and the snooker leagues and the pool leagues around the Northwest are massive as a sort of tradition. And then the third show, you've got two fellow Northerners, one Yorkshireman in Kel Brook, as you know, undefeated in the welterweight division and only defeated once by the best man on the planet in Gennady Golovkin. And then this other guy needs no introduction, Carl Fogarty, Lancashire lad.
Yeah.
From, I think he's from Blackburn. Something like that. So yeah, we've got them two are against each other. So three absolute belted episodes. Would have sort of concluded by the time the show's on. So yeah, there'll be plenty of chat, that's for sure.
Fantastic. And obviously you'll be on the quarter stand all weekend, and the boss man, the big man we've been trying to get for a few years, is coming up this year, isn't he, Danny?
Yeah, so Dan's not missed him out of spite or ignorance or anything like that. He's literally, he had the operation one year, and the other year before, he had his holiday to South Africa booked.
That's right.
He booked well in advance, and I know that I think that was a year where, I don't know, the show date moved or whatever, and or it might have been the Christmas one, whatever. He's not been able to make one yet, so he's very excited about doing it this year, and he'll have a couple of very interesting... he's on both days, isn't he, Jamie?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, he is.
He'll have some really interesting stuff to say. He's very engaging as a talker, Dan, and I think the Northern contingent that'll be there will enjoy watching his talks, and he's really approachable on the stand. He won't be disappearing off into any green room. in between. He'll be there the whole time, mate.
Yeah, we'll be glad to see him. We had him on the Carpcast a couple of weeks ago, actually, and something about, you know, being interviewed on here and stuff. It's very different seeing somebody on TV, which is obviously heavily scripted, and in magazines where you've got time to think about stuff. I mean, there's no hiding from like a live conversation. You know, if you're a dick, you're a dick, and if you're not, you're not. And I think he was quite surprised at how sort of well received, and you know, I saw so many messages and posts, you know, basically saying, wow, you know, Danny seems to really care about the sport. And we know this, obviously, and you know this from working with him, yeah, being his friend, but the general public just see this image of a successful guy that's heavy on branding and marketing, and which is your fault, most of it, you know, the, as a marketing...
He started the trend, really, with the information given. And really, I always say to even the staff we employ now, I say, when you break it down, even when you work in marketing, all we try to do is give information that helps people enjoy their hobby more. And of course, that information will carry our products in it, the same as Nash will carry Nash products, Fox will carry... But all we're trying to do is help people enjoy their hobby more. And no man, I don't think, has done more information giving in the last sort of 10 to 15 years than Danny. You know, he's put himself out there more than anybody, and I think that's, you know, a lot of the other companies, their owners aren't involved at that level. I think to be fair, the only other guy that's is anywhere sort of has done as much media, well, not as much, but an amount of, is Kevin Nash. Apart from that, none of the other owners, you know, Peter Drennan doesn't do anything, Cliff Fox certainly never done anything, you know. Dave Preston, you know, before he sold it, he never did anything, really. So, you know, yes, he's a wealthy, successful man. He's been wealthy and successful for a reason, because he's put his blood, you know, blood, life and soul into this. And he's the one man, believe it or not, who's always said he never did it for the money. He never did it for the money, Dan. He did it so he could have just enough fishing, just enough money, so he could just go fishing all the time. Yeah. Which is probably like what a lot of people out there do. And I think that's part of the success, really, of Corder, and is because his ethos was right from the beginning. Like, and I know some people would laugh at that, thinking, oh no, that it can't be that. You know, look at your prices and all that. Well, our prices are more than someone who copies our stuff, because we did all the R&D and development and everything behind it, you know. And it goes to a shop, you know, where some guy can just rip you off some tackle brand for 5 minutes. They copy your hook, send it to China or Japan or whatever, and away you go. There's no development, no overhead, so of course it could be cheaper. It ain't as good. There you go.
Seems to be, we'll diversify a little bit here, but it seems to be more prevalent than ever that now, that you know, literally a month after a product's release, and I know how long it takes to develop a product and get it to market, from having molds made and packaging and, you know, changing things, and then literally somebody, as you say, grabs that hook or that crusher or whatever it is, sends it to China, a month later there's a load of cheap ones on the market, and like, it's that seems to be happening more than ever. Is there more of an issue with, you know, cost too much to
pursue copyright? I don't think anymore. No, I don't think so. I mean, most of the big companies have got quite strict, you know, patents against products or design, you know, design patents and stuff like that. So I don't think it's no bigger issue than it was when I started. I just think you've got a few more people sort of looking at carp fishing and trying to have a go, or angling as a whole. But they come and go, mate. I just think it's an occupational hazard. But I do believe the customers see through it and have trust and loyalty. That's the biggest thing, because I think for all the criticism you might get as a company for trying to sell your product in a video or an article, because of course you're going to do that. It's your product, and you're talking, you know, I'm not going to show a rig and then put a Fox hook on it and a Nash lead, am I? You know, I'm going to talk because we believe what we produce is the best for the job, because that's what we use and believe. The same as someone there will believe that's the best, and it's those that give the information and help the anglers the most along their journey that builds the most trust with them. And that's what, you know, that's what we've tried to do. And I think, like I say, Dan absolutely loves, funnily enough, I say Dan at times when he does filming, because he's so focused on information and being so particular with exactly the name of the product, exactly how it's put together. Some people go, oh, you know, I caught he's sort of really plugging his stuff, but he's not, he's just mega detailed, Dan. You know, we always used to joke about Dan that he could write, you know, 10,000 words on a white bucket lid, you know, but that is what made the man great in business, and what, you know, what, how that company's evolved, you know, what, the same as other people have done well in business, because they just have that attention and passion about the technical side of fishing. But when you actually, like, you know, you've done this interview with him on the Carpcast, when you talk to Dan on a social, relaxed level, you know, he's one of the nicest guys you'll ever talk to. He's one of the most welcoming, and he'll, you know, he'll talk to anyone. I hope loads of the Northerners will see that for themselves in the coming show.
Yeah, I'm really glad that he's coming. I know people, you know the show, they're hungry for the information. It's one of the few shows where they haven't seen it all a million times, you know, like quite often, you know, the South's been saturated with shows for a lot of years, and, you know, it's still very new, and getting people that haven't been before, like Danny, who's got a lot to offer, you know, people will love it, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, well, Dan, you'll laugh about this, mate. At the end of a show, on a Saturday and a Sunday, Dan is physically, I mean, you might need to beep it, he's absolutely fucked, mate, at the end of a show. He's so exhausted talking to people all day, so passionately. And I think that goes for a lot of people at the shows. And angling, don't need to just say Dan or me or people. One of the great things about our sport and these exhibitions is that we are extremely approachable, and you will meet very, very few people that won't engage in conversation and try to help you, you know. Maybe by 4:30 on the last day or whatever, they're down and out in Beverly Hills, but, you know, get them when they're fresh throughout the day, and they're, you know, they'll chat and help and do whatever they can until their ears are bleeding and they can't converse anymore.
Hopefully you'll all join us for a beer. We've got a bit of entertainment on the Saturday afternoon, sort of kicking off about 4 o'clock. We've got Clive Gibbons' band on. We've put together a carping band, a northern carp band, and we've got a DJ playing a bit of cool stuff, and hopefully Dan and yourself.
I've got my mate's birthday in Manchester that night as well, so I've got to go to that. That'd be good. It's been quite lucky the last few years. You've done the dates, and then it's matched up with one of my good pals up there's birthday or whatever. So, and do you know what? Believe it or not, last year at the Northern Angling Show, I went out for my mate's birthday, and that was the night. The week before, I'd sent the email to Ricky Hatton's manager, and that very night, Ricky Hatton walked into the bar I was in Manchester, and that's pretty much where we sort of struck the deal with the relationship and got the ball rolling. So, sort of thanks to me being up there for your show. So, cheers for that.
Well, let's see who you'll meet this year. I'm sure.
Pamela Anderson. There's better ones in her nowadays. She's a bit worn out.
Yeah, she's my child. My childhood. You can't be far off as old as me. So. the younger carpy little guys, you know, the 18, 19 year olds, they won't even know she is. I don't think Baywatch wasn't around.
Yeah, but Baywatch running there. Yeah, I'm showing my age now, pal.
Well, I look forward to seeing you and Dan and the rest of the Corda guys.
Wicked, mate.
About 12 days time. This will be out tonight. It's very cool. Yeah, I was just waiting on you. Everything else is done, so we are rocking. We'll be out. Come and see the Corda guys at the show. Ali hopefully won't have too much of a hangover on the Sunday.
I'm always good, mate. I'll be there with. I'm still the carp is high sold brilliantly. I've got a few copies left, so I'll be signing them for anyone that hasn't got one yet. There'll be new rigs on the stand. There'll be the new goose would have been launched just a few days before, so they'll be on sale. Loads of tips. Dubby's there, Pecky's there, Macy's there, you know, Belty lineup, and of course some of the other companies have got plenty of top characters there. Alan Blair, you know, brilliant talker and always so engaging. There'll be loads to come and see, and I hope as many people as possible can possibly miss a weekend of fishing to load their brains up with loads of information or make them catch even more through the year. That's what you've got to remember, I think. You miss a weekend of actually being out on the bank angling because of the timing of the show, but you're going to gain for it throughout the year. That's what I'd say.
Fantastic. I'll see you then, pal.
Cheers, mate.
So a huge thank you to Ali, and hopefully sweat the appetite a little bit for the Northern Angling Show. So that's pretty much it for this show. I did forget to mention it right at the very start, and how could we forget, because the official Carpcast sponsor is Clearwater Fisheries. If you haven't seen the work that's going down on one of the finest fishing complexes in the Northwest, then check out the Carpcast Facebook page, the official Carpcast fan page. You can see the videos of all the work they've been doing on the lakes. To give you a brief history, Alex has recently purchased the complex and is turning it to one of the finest fisheries in the country. Spent hundreds of thousands of pounds on fencing, resculpting the lakes, planting the wildlife shrubbery, reducing the fishing footprint, and making the lake one of the most enjoyable places to fish there is. I'm doing some tuition on there. I've been doing some coaching lessons and experiencing the fishing at first hand. There's fish to over £40 already in the lake. There's runs waters being developed, and it's just a really enjoyable place to go, and will be one of the most sought after tickets in the country in the future. There's also match fishing lakes and stuff on there. It's just a little bit of everything, and we haven't even spoke about the cafe. The cafe is amazing. And if you want to have a chat with Alex and the gang from down there, you can also catch them at the Northern Angling Show this year, 1st and 2nd of April, where I'm sure you can get your name down on the waiting list. You can come and check them out on the stand, have a look at the pictures of the fish, and they're also sponsoring the catering area. So when you're in there for the carp group, the masturbators, and all the DJ and fun and stuff that's going on, in the bar area, you'll be very aware of the presence of Clearwater in there. So that's it. That's it from us. We'll be back next week. We'll get one more show in before the Northern Angling Show, and we'll see you then.
Check out the website at www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.